So the Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform is called to order. I want to welcome everyone, members, as well as the public, to this information hearing today. I am Representative Carlos Mariani. I'm the chair. And frankly, this is my first online virtually conducted hearing of a committee in the House. It may even be the first one. House, maybe that's just my experience. So I would ask the public and members as we work through both the technology and the process for the course of the next couple of hours. So your patience greatly appreciated. Please know that this hearing is being recorded and will be available on the committee webpage, which is itself on the House webpage. And while we're conducting the discussion via a video instrument, we're using the Zoom instrument, the hearing itself will be available for live viewing by going to the House live stream website and on Facebook Live, and I'm told on YouTube as well. You can find those links on our Minnesota House website for the committee page. There's several links there that you can link up in order to view those live streams. Public citizens have signed up to testify prior to the hearing. If anyone in the public wishes to offer comments, and if time permits for additional comments, you can email Jamal Lundy at house.emn. That's Jamal, J-A-M-A-E-L, J-A-M-A-E-L, dot Lundy, L-U-N-D-Y, L-U-N-D-Y, at house.mn. Committee members will be participating mostly through video, but some will be via audio, only depending on their locally available capacity for to access broadband. A reminder to all the members to either click on the participants button on their Zoom page to virtually raise their hand if they have a question that they want the chair to call on them for. Barring any technological or given any technological glitches with that, you can also email Jamal at that email address or text me. I've organized today's meeting around the three broad areas around which the Public Safety COVID Intermediate Response Bill is, the draft is currently structured. Those three areas are victims, survivors, advocacy issues, law enforcement issues, and corrections management issues. We will hear testimony from representatives from these groups for 20 minutes in each one of those groups. We'll also be hearing others offering testimony on their issues. Following that, committee members will ask questions, so we'll entertain, the chair will entertain questions from committee members for an additional 20 minutes. During that period of time, if there are amendments to that particular subject area, then the writers, the drafters of those amendments will quickly go through that language. So again, it's a 20-minute presentation from a variety of testifiers, followed by 20 minutes of either a description of an amendment followed by 20 minutes of description of amendment and questions and answers from the committee and the testifiers. Members, I'm probably not alone in constantly tracking our Minnesota Department of Health website. It's a terrific tool that constantly keeps us pretty up to date on a daily basis of the trajectory of this dangerous virus in our state. And I am sure I am, you are all as struck as I am by the steady growth of infections. Tragically, we have seen also instances of death related to the coronavirus. I'm sure, again, I'm not alone in expressing my grave concern and sharing that I haven't seen anything like this in my my existence here in Minnesota. There are a few other big grave threats that many of us have lived through, but this is a pretty big threat to the life and health and well-being of our entire state and every individual that resides in it. Today's conversation really starts from a desire to meet our responsibilities as committee members of the Public Safety Criminal Justice Reform Committee to look at the intersection of public health and public safety. To the extent that we are strongly informed by that review, that we then act quickly, probably quicker than we normally do. We're a very deliberative body by design, and we certainly will hold to that standard of deliberation, but there's also a sense of urgency for us to act on things that can contribute to the public health and public safety of our state in the midst of this incredible crisis. So these are unique times, which requires a unique sense of urgency, a unique sense of action on our parts. So I'm looking forward to today's conversation. We're going to start the day with a call to order to establish a quorum and for the public to be aware of who is currently present. And so I'm going to ask committee members to unmute their mute button. And I'm going to ask the clerk, Mr. Chavez, to then go through the roll call. And please, as you hear your name, announce your presence at that time. The clerk will take the roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start once everybody has unmuted themselves. Cool. Chair Mariani?
Present.
Representative Edelson?
Present.
Representative Johnson?
Present.
Representative Christensen?
Present.
Representative Considine?
Present.
Representative Dean?
Present.
Representative Howard?
Present.
Representative Lesh. Representative Lesh. Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Present.
Representative Miller.
Here.
Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Nash.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Lesh. Okay, so we do have a quorum.
Very well. We've established a quorum, members. Thank you. And perhaps the clerk, if you can just send shoot a message over to Chair Lesh. To let us know when he arrives so that we can also properly record him. We would typically see someone walk into a room, but we're prevented from doing that at this time. Thank you, members. We have, this is an informational hearing. We do not have a bill introduced. We have bill language that's been constructed and it's in draft form. Obviously, it's been constructed for a little bit over a week, just kind of an ongoing process of engagement with a broad array of Minnesotans and committee members. So we're not in a position to formally act on a bill, but there is a vitally important function that we have to play today in terms of sharing with one another our ideas, using the bill as the focal point, and just as crucially important, sharing that with the public as well. So we're not going to be taking any motions today other than the approval of the minutes from our last meeting. And that'll actually be a good practice for us in the event that we hold more virtual online meetings in the coming weeks. So with that, I'm going to ask, I don't have the date of the minutes. I'm going to ask our clerk what the date of the draft minutes, what is the date on?
March 12th.
March 12th. Okay, very well. I will need a motion to.
So moved.
12 minutes. So Chair Kotsen and I moves adoption of the March 12th minutes. Discussion, members. Hearing no discussions, all in favor? Oh, wait a minute. We have to do this by
roll call.
Hate to do this to everyone, but that's all. We're going to have to do it. So with that, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Yes.
Representative Edelson?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Christensen?
Yes.
Representative Considine?
Yes.
Representative Dean?
Yes.
Representative Howard?
Yes.
Representative Lesh? Representative Long?
Yes.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Miller?
Yes.
Representative Moeller?
Yes.
Representative Nash?
Yes.
Representative Novotny?
Yes.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Poston?
Yes.
We have 16 ayes and then one either absent excused.
Very well. So then the motions, or the motion to adopt the March 12th minutes are approved. Representative Johnson, I've been in the legislature for a number of years, and I have to say I can't recall another time when I've actually participated in a roll call on the minutes. perhaps you have, but I haven't.
That's the first for me.
I'm afraid there's going to be a number of firsts for all of us, and hopefully they'll all be very good firsts. Members, then with that, I'm going to call on our House research staff to walk through, not in depth, but just to do a walkthrough of the draft bill before us. That will then allow the public in particular to orally hear, what's in the bill before us. That document should be online, again, on our webpage, which is our committee page on the Minnesota House webpage. So with that, I'll turn this over to both Mr. Johnson and Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair, this is Jeff Diebel.
Please, Mr. Diebel, proceed.
Thank you. Section one of the document, the bill draft in front of you, permits or requires the Commissioner of Corrections and Sheriffs to post daily inmate population numbers for prisons, jails, and juvenile detention centers on their publicly accessible websites. Section two is a bill introduced by Representative Long, and this permits access, allows coroners access to the Criminal Justice Data Communications Network, and coroners and medical examiners, so that they can identify unidentified deceased persons. And that's House File 3730. At this point, I'd ask that you recognize Mr. Johnson to cover the.
Very well, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, this is Ben Johnson with House Research. Sections 3 through 7 and section 10 are from Representative Pinto's House File 4137. There's one slight change to the introduced version of that bill. Section 4 of that bill, which dealt with harassment, stalking, and firearms, has been removed and does not appear in the language before you. Mr. Chair and members, this language is related to a Supreme Court case that struck down as unconstitutional one provision of the current harassment and stalking statute. And this is an attempt to find a way to make that language now constitutional. Mr. Chair, I'd ask that you recognize Mr. Diebel again.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair, continuing with the overview with Section 8, this is a temporary emergency power granted to the Commissioner of Corrections. Actually, it contains two provisions, but the first is to allow for the commissioner to release inmates with 180 days or less in their sentence imprisonment early if the commissioner determines that they are low risk to reoffend and do not present a foreseeable risk to public safety. That's subdivision 3 of section 8. Subdivision 4 of Section 8 is the other substantive provision of Section 8, and this directs the Commissioner of Corrections to provide free calls and video conferences if the Commissioner closes the facility to in-person visitation during the COVID-19 outbreak. And the other qualification on this requirement is that the commissioner has to have a means of funding that, either through repurposing their own funds or an appropriation from the governor or another means, but the requirement only applies if there's funds available to cover the expense. And again, these provisions are only applicable, these emergency provisions, while there's a state of emergency for the COVID-19 pandemic. Subdivision 5 of Section 8 requires the commissioner to report within 180 days on how the agency and the commissioner exercise the authority granted under this section. Moving to Section 9, which is entitled COVID-19 Testing of Public Safety Specialists, this section directs healthcare providers to test public safety specialists, which is defined in this section broadly. When they test public safety specialists for COVID-19, the healthcare provider must notify the public safety specialist of whether the person has tested positive or negative for COVID-19 as soon as possible. And Mr. Chair, as mentioned, Section 10 was part of Representative Pinto's bill that Mr. Johnson covers, so that concludes our overview of the bill draft.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Mr. Johnson, and of course, it all sounds pretty dry and technical. If I'm sitting in from the public, I'm like, well, what does all that mean? And that will therefore then be the subject of the discussion over the course of this hearing. We're gonna hear from individuals that, and groups that we meaning the committee, reached out to solicit advice about things that we could be legislating at this point that would be helpful given their concerns related to the virus itself. And then we'll have a question and answer period after each one of these big chunks to then have a fuller conversation among members relative to the provisions. So with that, we're going to move into the first section, which is a presentation from survivor and victims' advocates on COVID effects on survivor advocate work and individuals. And first up, we have, and I think they may be coming up together. First up, we'll have Ms. Artika Roller with Minkaza, as well as Ms. Liz Richards from Violence Free Minnesota. So let's see how we do with the technology in terms of getting them up on the screen before us. And I don't know who's going to go first, and I'm still looking for my feed so I can. Let me give this a minute. So members, it looks like we're about to see a Violence-Free Minnesota visual presentation of their testimony. And obviously we'll hear from a representative as well. And if you're muted, if you're presiding, make sure your mute button is off. And so far, I'm not seeing anything. Is any member seeing anything moving? We'll get this.
Chair Mariani, yes. This is Representative Dean. It appears that we have not had the PowerPoint opened up yet. So until we see that, I think we're sort of in a little bit of stasis.
I'm afraid you may be right about that. Do we have audio from, I'm assuming this is Liz Richards from Violence Free Minnesota? I'm not hearing that either. And I now have the live feed on my other screen, and I'm seeing the same thing that we're seeing here. I'm wondering if our committee administrator can reach out to Ms. Richards to see what might be the hang-up.
No.
Artika's on the line. I don't see Liz.
Oh, all right. Artika, are you there?
I believe I'm on. This is Liz Richards.
Oh, hi, Liz.
Hi.
Welcome. So I take it you're trying to open this PowerPoint and it's not happening. At least we're not seeing it on this end.
You aren't.
Is that correct? Members, this is what happens when you try to be the first ones to do things. I'm seeing Ms. Richards now, and I do see the first screen of the PowerPoint.
The PowerPoint is now being shared?
It looks that way. Other members, okay. I think, are seeing it.
Is Artika Roller with us?
Jason, I think you had mentioned that Ms. Roller was with us at one point.
I did see her on the screens.
She is on there.
She's smiling too, so I think maybe she doesn't have her audio on. Hey, Artika, do you want to raise your hand if you hear us? She's speaking, but I don't think she can.
Yeah, I think she doesn't know her, perhaps her mute is on. Does anyone have her phone number and can text her that she needs to unmute?
I think that what might be going on is not the unmute, but I had to rejoin with my audio once I came out of the waiting room.
Oh, you know, there was something mentioned about this when we went through our trial runs.
Right, so I don't know if anybody has the ability to communicate with Artika and let her know that.
Nope.
Nope. There we go.
Okay. No, I'm here.
Very well. It's good to see you, Ms. Roller.
Good to see you, Chair.
Very well. We are in your hands, you and Ms. Richards. Proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Great. Thank you. Chair Mariani and members of the committee, I'm Liz Richards, the Executive Director of Violence Free Minnesota.
Chair Mariani and members of the committee, I'm Artika Roller, the Executive Director of Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault.
Welcome to you both.
Our statewide coalitions represent more than 100 programs who are providing domestic violence and sexual violence services across 87 counties in the state of Minnesota.
And our domestic and sexual violence programs provide essential services. In 2011, during the government shutdown, our programs were found to be critical core functions of government, and we have continued to be considered essential services, having a direct and immediate impact on the public safety of Minnesotans. Under the current Emergency Executive Order 2020, directing Minnesotans to stay at home, our services were exempted as critical essential services, and indeed our programs across the state are open and providing services for those experiencing abuse and violence.
And
I think we're trying to coordinate our testimony remotely. Working on this. So part of the question that is out there is, what do we know in terms of the impact of COVID-19 on the need for services for domestic and sexual violence victims? And I was going to start with just providing a little bit of information about what we're seeing nationally and even internationally. So in New York City, I believe this is, domestic violence calls to law enforcement are up between 15 and 20%. And if you look internationally, in the United Kingdom, they have had an increase of 25% in the calls to their national call line, and to websites, contacts seeking services are up 150%. We see this in other places, in Lebanon and Malaysia. Helpline calls have doubled. In China, they've tripled. Last week, I was in a conversation with our colleagues in Seattle. Seattle, in the month of March, saw a 21% increase in domestic violence calls to law enforcement officers in that city. So then the question becomes, what are we seeing here in Minnesota? Day one is Minnesota's statewide crisis hotline for domestic violence victims. And for the 2 weeks immediately before the stay-at-home order, the calls coming into the statewide crisis line were up 10% over the previous year, the same corresponding weeks. Since the stay-at-home order was issued, for that first week after the stay-at-home order, they reported a 26% increase in calls to the domestic violence hotline. We don't yet have data from our individual programs around the state, but our programs in general are reporting that requests for services are remaining steady. Some programs are seeing an increase. Some of the things that we have from the crisis hotline day one, they are hearing in terms of the callers that are calling their hotline that not only are they calling in generally, but people are reporting an escalating violence happening within the home, and that survivors are saying that they're having an extremely difficult time finding a space in which they can even reach out for assistance, that they are oftentimes saying they are practically never alone and able to make those phone calls. And I think Artika is going to speak a little bit about what they're seeing with sexual violence.
Thanks, Liz. The Sexual Violence Center has seen about a 20% increase in crisis calls, while their in-person services and their one-on-one counseling and support has decreased since the stay-at-home order. We're also hearing from a local hospital that the week prior to the stay-at-home order, they had actually seen an increase for the need of SANE nurses in the hospital. They usually operated with one nurse, and that week prior, they had to elevate their staff to two nurses.
So in response to these increased calls, our programs have moved, in response to the COVID crisis generally, our programs have moved whatever services they can to remote work. While it's not possible with all of our services, and when it's not possible, what they've been doing is instituting physical distancing and increased disinfecting and hygiene practices. So our programs, in terms of continuing in-person services, those in-person services continue for things like our shelter programs, our parenting time centers, providing transportation, and a variety of other types of advocacy support that can't be handled in any way other than direct contact. So I think where we want to go next is we want to highlight some of the needs and impacts that our survivors and our programs are experiencing directly due to COVID-19. And I'm going to speak about some of those needs, and then Artika is. The things that I'm talking about are things that are being experienced by both domestic and sexual violence programs and vice versa.
Very well.
So first, the first thing I want to highlight is what I'm going to call supply chain issues. All of our shelters and parenting time centers have a need for and are having trouble securing protective gear, including things like masks, gloves, other personal protective equipment. They are also in need of and struggling to secure is disinfecting and cleaning supplies in order to maintain the health and safety of those in shelter and at the parenting time centers. You know, they're instituting practices such as only having one family at a time in the center and fully disinfecting the area and all the toys. So there's an increased demand for cleaning supplies and protective gear, and that they're having trouble securing that. Many of our programs do not have a direct wholesale relationship and are experiencing the difficulty securing things like hand sanitizers, toilet paper, paper towels, tissues, thermometers, as well as those cleaning supplies and protective gear. Some of our shelters and those who are running housing units are struggling to get easy access to sufficient perishable foods because of the caps that a number of places are placing on the amount of perishable foods people can purchase at a time. So those are some of the supply chain issues that our programs are experiencing. We have a whole host of issues around alternative housing and an increased need of access to some alternative housing and potentially hotel space. And that's both in order to trying to access that space and securing the funds to cover these unexpected costs. So I'm gonna break this down into some various categories. So first, our shelters are all in communication with the Minnesota Department of Health and their local public health officials. And they're implementing physical distancing within the shelters to follow the appropriate health public health recommendations. So they're adjusting things like not having non-relatives sharing a bedroom. They're also increasing the space between beds following those guidelines. So what that has meant is it has meant that most of our shelters are not able to house the same number of people as they institute those guidelines. And so they're looking for overflow space to extend their shelter bed space. Others of our programs are looking for space for individuals who need to be isolated or for if they have high risk residents within the shelter because they have underlying medical conditions or they're pregnant. They're looking for space outside the shelter that would be safer for them to be in rather than being located in the larger congregate living situation in shelter. All of our shelter programs are deeply concerned about their ability to safely provide quarantine services, specifically for family units within the shelter. We know we've had one program who has already instituted a quarantine process working with the public, their local public health officials for a family unit. It was a mother and three children, and being able to provide that family-based quarantine within shelter. Our programs are concerned about being able to maintain health and safety for everybody within that shelter. Our programs are looking at how to increase their overall capacity. Minnesota's domestic violence shelter bed space is normally at or near full capacity, even without the stay-at-home order, without COVID. So from what we're learning from other states like California and Washington, where they were hit by the crisis ahead of Minnesota, and also from what we're seeing in the increased volume of calls to the day one hotline, we are going to need to be able to expand our shelter bed capacity. So those are the issues that are very specific to our shelters and housing. In addition to that, while we have 26 emergency domestic violence shelters in the state, there are many areas of the state where we do not have emergency shelters. So victims in those areas of the state rely on domestic violence programs to secure them safe housing. So our programs in those areas primarily rely on hotel motel to do safe housing for victims in their communities. So with the closure of hotels and motels, we are losing safe housing space in those communities. So our programs are currently in negotiation with hotels, and I just wanna acknowledge the support that we're receiving from Hospitality Minnesota in trying to address those hotel needs. But there are additional costs built in because we are asking a hotel who might otherwise shut down to keep on a minimal staff, keep them employed in the shelter so that there are bed spaces available when we need them. And so we don't typically have set aside space. We activate it and pay for it when we actually have somebody to use the bed space that night. So we're looking at some additional costs to keep bed space open and available in hotels that otherwise might shut down. The other things is that our programs are trying to be as innovative as possible. One of the challenges with victim survivors and their family members staying in hotels is how do we get them the necessary food and supplies while they're in hotel spaces? So there's a host of housing issues and concerns that we're facing and working to deal with. The next area I want to talk about is transportation issues. Public transportation, particularly transportation outside the metro area, was already limited and a barrier for many survivors who were trying to seek safety. Now we have public transportation in some towns that's actually fully closed down. Other places it's been with drastically reduced hours and coverage. So our programs are finding themselves picking up more of the transportation needs across the state, figuring out ways for survivors and their families to get to safety and to get to the other places they need to go. And indeed, some of our programs are looking at how can we train our staff so that they can safely transport where that's not been their role in the past. So transportation is a huge issue. The last area that I'm going to talk about is emergency assistance. We're finding that as other services are shutting down or becoming more difficult to access in our communities, our programs are seeing greater demands for them. Many survivors that we're working with do not have access to the internet, and that many of them had relied on places like public libraries to do internet access. So our programs are helping them gain that access to things like to file for unemployment benefits, to be able to secure other county benefits. And so this has been a huge issue out there, just finding internet access for people to be able to get some of the assistance that they need. We know that the demand for food shelves and other daily supports is up, and our programs are absorbing many of those requests. We know that food shelves are struggling to maintain their services due to a lack of volunteers, and our programs are filling more of those requests. And those are requests not just for food, but we have programs experiencing requests for rental assistance, other basic living needs. And our programs are saying they are seeing people coming into them asking for assistance where in the past they know that they were using other community-based services. And the requests for assistance go beyond just the financial requests for basic needs. We know that as many of the county benefits offices, if not all of them, and as the courthouses are closing to in-person access, that creates a barrier, and our programs are helping to bridge that. For courthouses in particular, and specifically for victim survivors who do not have attorneys representing them, they are having difficulty accessing the courts for the support they need. So our programs are being asked to do more across all of these areas to sort of fill in those gaps. That's the information that we have right now. We are both meeting both jointly and separately with our members every week, gathering more information. And we're looking not only at immediate needs, but what are the needs going to be looking like 3-6 months out, looking further down the road. I think with that, I'm going to turn it over to Artika to talk about some of the things that they're seeing.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. I certainly learned quite a bit here, and I'm feeling myself a little bit overwhelmed with the incredible challenges that you and others are facing and helping to keep our public safe, particularly in terms of domestic violence and other violence directed at households. Ms. Roller.
Yes. So working together, meeting the needs of programs, Liz talked about individual survivor needs and highlighted some of the program needs as well, but I'll talk specifically about our organizations and what they are facing. Our organizations are challenged with, again, the operations, operating remotely and continuing to provide direct service. Our staffing costs for our programs have increased because expectations of the staff have also increased. And we're placing staff into risky situations. They're also concerned about being able to retain sufficient and healthy staff and all the pay or the salary costs that are involved with that. Unfortunately, we do have two executive directors that are have tested positive for COVID-19. And the organizations are struggling with that because they need help with succession plans. Who takes over the responsibilities of those executive directors when they become sick? And they also have staff that are experiencing symptoms of COVID-19. So we've been helping staff develop successions plans, connecting them with employment attorneys, and also putting together the emergency policies so they can continue to build for the services that they are currently providing victim survivors, and also so they're in compliance with our VOCA and VAWR funding dollars. The other area that we see staff, again, it's with supplies. They are just need basic supplies, wipes, masks, disinfectant, laptops for their staff to work remotely, and cell phones. And then technology is also, Liz talked a little bit about technology, but many of our programs are scrambling to purchase and set up technology that will allow them to move to remote home locations and to offer services remotely. Along with that technology, they're struggling to find confidential platforms to use so they can continue services. And not only struggling to find those confidential platforms to use, but also the costs that are associated with it. A lot of programs are currently using things like Zoom that allow some free supports to communicate, but they're not necessarily compliant and confidential. And those platforms, for example, Zoom is probably $200 a month for their HIPAA compliant platform. IT assistance to set up things has also been a challenge for programs that have not had a robust IT system. And then in smaller communities, just bandwidth. The bandwidth is being overloaded and they are not able to use that for their staff and then continue to provide services. Reduction in access, as Liz talked about with court, but they're also seeing a reduction in their access to law enforcement. In smaller communities, they were using law enforcement as transportation or to do safe home visits, and law enforcement are denying those requests at this point in time because they feel like they have the limited capacity and capability to do that in a safe way. Again, increase in services and non-traditional services, and then a lack of resources and capacities, again, to support what they need to do their work in what we are calling our new normal or a different environment. So what do programs need to function? programs are asking for additional funding so they can catch up to speed to the things that they need to do. They are seeing increasing expenses on a daily basis. Again, technology, VPN licenses, fees to access confidential platforms, and then best practices around IT. They need support to make sure that they're adhering to what would be compliant. And then staffing programs. Again, increase pay for staff working in spaces that they might be exposed to greater risk, and increase staffing in general for crisis calls. Liz and I both talked about the increase in hotline calls, but to have staff available for 24 hours to actually take those calls. What do programs need to keep survivors accessing their services? Legal support is probably one of the top things that we're hearing that's around confidentiality and employment issues. They're also asking for some graphics and social media messaging things so they can keep the community informed about what's going on. One of the things that we have been hearing in our programs is that victim survivors weren't aware that programs were still open and offering services. The other thing that we unfortunately heard is that victim survivors did not want to access emergency room assistance because they felt like they didn't want to burden the our medical system, although they were in crisis or had an emergency as well. And then finally, DV and SA programs need specific funding, again, for shelter and hotels and housing.
So I think the last piece that we're going to kind of touch on is what are our requests for you, right? What are we asking you for? And one of the first things that we're really asking from each one of you is if you can get the word out to your constituents that domestic and sexual violence programs are open, we are available. Violence Free Minnesota sent each one of you committee members an email late on Friday with a request to share information with constituents, and we included these social media graphics about our services remaining open. So that would be extremely helpful. We've also started a campaign asking any of the businesses that are still open, providing essential services, to post signs and to include the crisis line numbers on their store receipts. We've received some amazing support from Minnesota Grocers, the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association, and the Municipal Beverage Association and retailers in advancing this work with us. If there are other ways that any of you can provide support to this work trying to get the information out, we would certainly welcome it. We do have some specific legislative requests. First, we want to thank you for including $26.5 million for housing needs under the COVID aid package that was recently passed. We are hopeful that some of our programs' needs can be met through that fund. It just went live on April 1st, and our people are submitting requests currently for some of those housing dollars. We're here today also specifically testifying in support of the Omnibus Intermediate Emergency COVID Response Bill. We support the provisions that allow the Department of Correction to do early release, and we appreciate the specific inclusion of victim notification requirements in that bill. I want to let you know that the Department of Corrections has been proactively reaching out to us as coalitions as they respond to the crisis and keeping us informed and as part of those decisions. So we are supportive of their ask as it appears in this bill and are working with them to continually address victim safety concerns. We also support and appreciate the specific inclusion of domestic and sexual violence victims for testing priority. As our advocates perform essential services and assume higher risks with face-to-face contact, it's reassuring to know that they have priority in the testing. Finally, while we know that you're not looking at funding bills at this point, we also know that there are financial impacts from the crisis that are already being felt by our programs across the state and will continue to be felt. Our programs rely very heavily on state and federal government funding. But as nonprofits, they also rely on support from their local communities. Many of our programs lost their opportunity for their spring fundraisers during Women's History Month and Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Spring is the season for local fundraisers. Our local communities are also suffering economic loss, which will mean less ability for the individuals in those communities and for local businesses to support our programs. We are also being told to prepare for a potential and significant loss of federal funding. We're at the beginning of this crisis. We know what some of the immediate needs are, but we're just starting to feel the fuller financial impact of this crisis and what it's going to mean for us in the coming years. We anticipate a need for increased government support for our essential services, and we estimate a need for an additional $20 million in state funding for both domestic and sexual violence programs. We will need your support not only now in the immediate crisis, but in the long term so we can continue to address the needs of survivors and children across the state. We want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today to provide this information about the work and the needs of domestic and sexual violence survivors and the programs who serve them. And we're available to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Richards, and thank you, Ms. Roller, for pretty full and concise presentation of both the challenges and the way in which your community of servants are looking to meet those challenges and what you need from your legislature in order to do that effectively and promote public safety. You know, just on that last point, Ms. Roller, it's true that at this point, have not received directives from our bipartisan leadership effort of late, to address appropriations issues, but obviously it's important that we talk about now and not later about what those can be. And it's precisely because this is a scenario in my mind, this is a scenario that is moving very rapidly across our state. We're talking exponential growth dynamics, which means literally the next day reality just greatly alters from the present day in terms of the threat and the challenge before us. And so I certainly would look forward to, in this particular committee, I look forward to probation-related services needs, many of which are community-based services, that we address the appropriation issues related to that. Much of the work that you're about, overlaps several of our appropriation streams, obviously. So the other thing we should be looking for is really good, tight coordination among our decisions here with state appropriations, as well as expecting that level of coordination of which you spoke of a few powerful instances already. With that, I'm going to open this up to questions, comments from members. Again, members, if you switch down to, or if you click down to the participants tab at the bottom of the of your Zoom screen, that'll pull up the list of participants, and then you have a choice to raise your hand. So if you click on that, that'll indicate that that you're asking to be recognized by the chair, and our committee administrator is monitoring that. And so I'm already seeing some questions starting to pop up. Let me see, however, I want to make sure that I'm following my own process here. So one of the things I want to do during the question and answer is to talk about the amendments that are related to that portion. And so let me do this. Let me ask if Representative Pinto can speak briefly to the A-10 amendment. And then I did note that Representative Dean, I think, was the first one who raised his hand. Representative Pinto, are you available to speak to the A10 amendment at this point?
Mr. Chair, I certainly can, if that's your preference. It sounds like it is. Otherwise, I certainly would be happy, though, if there may be questions that relate more generally to the topics that have been discussed up till this point, and happy to do that, whatever your preference. Would you prefer to move forward discussing that portion of the bill?
Given the amendment, let's do it the way you have just suggested. So I'll make sure to remind me to come back to you. Representative Dean, on deck here.
And this is a question to the advocates and their recent presentation. I'm sure that some of you have seen the ombudsperson's recommendation regarding those individuals that are still in confinement. And some of the ideas about, you know, early release for some of those nonviolent folks. And I've heard, you know, some people express concerns for victims through this process. And of course, the bill has added victim notification prior to release. Could you speak to that a little bit and talk about what some of the internal and external conversations that you all have been having?
I'm not sure on the protocol here, but should I just launch? So, Chair Mariani?
Yeah, Ms. Richards, please. Okay.
So, Chair Mariani, Representative Dean, we have been in fairly regular communication with the Department of Corrections throughout this process. I know that we've both had sort of individual conversations with them, and the department has also convened the shelter, the coalition together. Commissioner Schnell and his leadership team have jointly come and met with the coalitions, and I believe are scheduled to meet again with us on Wednesday morning. So we've been in conversations with them both about, and we are supportive of looking at the early release or of those who are towards the end of confinement. And the issues that we're discussing back and forth is how do we help them with their assessment about risk in terms of release, and also coordination with victim safety, not just victim notification, but how do we make sure that they are correctly connected up to make sure that they have whatever they need to address their needs as well. So we've been having a lot of conversations, and I think that there are conversations not only that are helpful here during the crisis, but I think that there are a number of things getting put into play that are good practices that will serve us well long after this particular crisis is over.
Thank you. Representative Dean?
Thank you for that. I think it gives us a little bit of direction on what's been happening in the meantime as this bill has been drafted as far as the inclusion of victim and survivor advocacy groups into that process. And it sounds like you all would be involved moving forward as well.
Yes. Okay. Ms. Roller, I'm sorry, you had something?
Chair, no, I was just nodding, affirming.
Okay, very well. I don't ask any questions, other questions right now, so why don't we go back to you, Representative Pinto, with the A10 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so members will recall the bill that we heard House File 4137, more than a month ago now, I think it was March 4th, that dealt with a portion of our state's stalking harassment law being declared unconstitutional. Change was made after that hearing in response to concerns expressed by Lee Johnson and the minority. And so the language now that we're seeing is the same as the language we saw now 5 weeks ago, whatever it was, but with that one change requested. It may be useful, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, just because this language is included in the bill at the specific request, in fact, of the coalition. So I don't know if it makes sense to ask Ms. Richards and Ms. Roller to just comment about where they see the this portion of the bill as being important in the COVID response and important for us to act now. And then we can certainly get to the amendment as you wish.
Very well. Ms. Richards or Ms. Fuller?
Chair Mariani, members of the committee, indeed, we did, when there was outreach made to us about what are some of the things that, some of the legislative changes that we thought could be helpful, specifically during this crisis, we did indeed reference the harassment bill. I would note that this is a bill that's supported by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association as well as the coalitions. And the reason specifically that we think that it's helpful to move this forward is precisely for the reasons that have been said. We have a Minnesota Supreme Court case that has found some critical portions of the statute to be unconstitutional. As we see the increase of what's happening around domestic and sexual violence in the state, we think it's critical that we have a harassment stalking bill that provides the full range of tools available to law enforcement and prosecutors to be able to respond. And so to move this bill forward is going to be helpful. Otherwise, what we're looking at is a year without having all of the components of the stalking harassment bill available to us if we have to wait until next session. So in light of what we know is going on within within families and homes in the state, we think it's important to get the fix to the Supreme Court case taken care of.
And Mr. Chair, with your
representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, members, maybe and again, we talked about this, you know, quite a while ago, more than a month ago now. But if we think that right now, victims of stalking and harassment, when we are trying to deal with those things, I think as members know, I prosecute these cases and I work outside the legislature. Right now, we are fighting stalking harassment with one hand tied behind our back because a portion has been declared unconstitutional. And I will say, frankly, that I think that there's a risk, as you read the opinion, that Supreme Court opinion, that we're going to have a second arm tied behind our back as well, and that we're going to be watching stalking and harassment happen and be able to do nothing about them. So as you recall from the hearing quite a while back now, what we've done is taken language from the federal statute and brought it in a way that our state's prosecutors and victim advocates believe will be really helpful and will stand up to that, to future scrutiny and be able to be protective of victims of stalking harassment, which gets us to the A10 amendment. Comes about as a result of a conversation I've had with Representative O'Neill. There's some concern about language in current law that enhances stalking harassment crimes when the offender, the defendant, possesses a firearm during the offense or at the time of the offense. And in discussion, one of the thoughts would be to have to change that to cause that enhancement when the offender uses a firearm in the commission of the offense. This is language that comes from other parts of statute. I should note that the current possession language does as well. And I should also note that the County Attorney Association has expressed support for the language as is. I have not heard back yet for their thoughts about the amendment. And of course, we can't take official action right now anyway. But what we're doing is being able to, I wanted to bring it forth, Mr. Chair and members, to have folks be aware of it and discuss it. But I think it could make a lot of sense. That'd be a change to existing law, but could be something that we could do as well. So, but we really do, it is critical that we act. That we act now to protect victims. Thank you.
So Pintle, just your last comment. The A10 amendment would reflect change to existing law?
Yeah, so and what I mean by that is that under existing law, if you do a single accident of harassment, that's a gross misdemeanor. There are various ways that harassment can become stalking, which would be multiple. Well, one of the ways harassment can become a felony, I should note, is if there's multiple incidents, then it's stalking, and that's a felony. But there are other ways it can be a felony. Under existing law, that single incident of harassment becomes a felony if the offender possesses a firearm at the time of the offense. This proposal, the language that's currently in your bill, Mr. Chair, drawn from House File 4137, doesn't touch that at all, that business about possession of a firearm. It simply makes the changes necessary to make our harassment and stalking laws constitutional. What Amendment A10 would do is to make that change relating to possession of a firearm, change it to use of a firearm in the commission of the offense. And that's what I mean, is that it actually affects part of the statute would not currently be affected. But of course, it's connected very firmly to to the language that is being amended, that would be amended through your bill. Hope that that makes sense. Maybe a little bit confusing, but hopefully it.
No, I think it does. Yeah, and so the intent in offering an A10 amendment would be for the sake of what, just being able to move forward with the overall.
Well, it would be. I mean, and again, I want to hear get feedback. This is something that we came up pretty recently, and so we're gathering feedback. I hope to get so very quickly, I think that may well make some sense as being a change to make, and then it's something that it sounds like would be quite important to members of the minority, and to and we certainly want to reach consensus as we have been all the way along in our work in fighting COVID, and so. This, like the change that we've already made to this bill, would be something we'll be trying to get consensus and move it forward.
Well, and I for the sake of full transparency, I do want to just publicly share the fact that when we acted on your bill, we moved that over to Chair Lesch's committee in Judiciary for further review. I know that the chair there is looking at that carefully. We're in unusual times, right? I mean, we don't have a bill here. We have language. We have a very specific bill in Chair Lesch's committee that can certainly act. The point is that when there is action, if there will be action on April 14th, floor chamber activities, which is all about, moving as expeditiously as we can. We certainly heard a bit of the urgency from both Ms. Roller and Ms. Richards in terms of acting now, that we act in a way in which, both committees that are reviewing this language, are comfortable with. And of course, within this time frame, we're talking about all four of our caucuses, checking off on the provisions. All right, thank you. So with that, I'm going to move to Representative O'Neill and then Representative Moeller. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would actually ask at this time if we could take some public testimony specific to this portion of the bill. I would put that out there first. I know that there are a couple people in the waiting room that are interested in weighing in. I understand that public or the county attorneys have weighed in, but who hasn't weighed in, to my knowledge, is the defense lawyers, the public, the public defenders, the defense lawyers, and the gun groups have not weighed in. And the reason that's important is because there are two sections of this bit of bill that play into the prohibited person statutes, which is 624.713. So I think we need to be mindful of that also. So I realize that this is trying to fix something that was stricken by the Minnesota Supreme Court. And in addition to asking if we could have some public testimony at this time, I'd also ask if I could have a question answered by nonpartisan research.
Why don't we do this, Representative O'Neill? We're already starting to go over a little bit over time. There are people in the waiting room, so I do want to hear from them. What I'd like to do is make sure that all our presenters on this bill get to speak and that we have an opportunity for members to engage with those testifiers. Question and answer first, and then we can circle back, to other individuals who have asked to speak. I suspect we're going to go over the time that we normally are. I'm perfectly okay with that. I think many of you probably are as well. So we should be able to get, all that testimony in. Keeping with that, and I leave it to you, maybe this might be a good time for you to ask a question, but if you want to wait, I can come back after those testifiers come forward. But I do want to get all our presenters of the bill speaking, so we're going to wander off of this topic, at some point as we do that. So do you want to be able to pose a question right now, Representative O'Neill?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this relates directly to this amendment and this portion of the bill. That's why I thought it'd be more expedient to do all of that at one time as opposed to break it up. But I do have a specific question for nonpartisan research to give more clarity into this portion of the bill and specifically the amendment. And my question is, so which parts of this section of statute were specifically struck down by the Minnesota Supreme Court? And how long did that process take? I was made aware that the initial court ruling was in 2016. I believe the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled in 2019. So that's a three-year process, if they could confirm that. Specifically, what was struck and how long did that process take before that was deemed unconstitutional? And since it has been deemed unconstitutional, what are we left with in the harassment statute?
Very well. I don't know if that's a Mr. Deem or Mr. Johnson question.
Mr. Chair, this is Ben Johnson. I can answer some of that right now. I'm going to need a few minutes to get to some of the other portions of it, if that's acceptable.
Very well. Please give us what you can at this moment.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill and members, the Supreme Court decision was called Matter of Welfare of AJB. That decision did come down earlier this, late last year, but I mean, 2019. In that, the Supreme Court specifically looked at only one provision, and that was it's section 609.749, subdivision 2, clause 6. That's the provision that it directly struck down. I think Representative Pinto may want to speak to his concerns and prosecutors' concerns about how that decision may have affected other sections of the statute. The Supreme Court only addressed the question that was presented to it, but its logic and reasoning may apply to other things. In terms of the timing of this, Mr. Chair, I'll need just a couple of minutes to pull up how long ago that case began and track down the Court of Appeals opinion. If you give me 2 minutes, I'll be back.
Very well. Representative Bentley, do you want to add anything to that particular piece?
I'll just note that the concern, and very much as Mr. Johnson was alluding to, the concern among our state's prosecutors is that the logic that applied to the one clause would apply to others. I might actually, regarding the one clause, if I can suggest, I know that Representative Moeller actually has had direct experience with a case that in fact was blocked as a result of the specific Supreme Court ruling. So we have an example of someone who, in fact, has already been denied justice as a result of this. So it's a real urgent matter. So it might make sense. She'd probably be in a better position than I would, honestly, regarding the specific clause.
I do have Representative Mueller on the list, but I don't want to depart from Representative O'Neill, right, who asked the initial question. Representative O'Neill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would point out that if anyone following along in the bill that we have before us, bill draft, I should say, because it's not been introduced and this bill has not been had its first reading, nor has it been referred to us. But if you look at page 6, and it's line 6.19 through 6.22, and it's clause 6, which reads, repeatedly mails or delivers or causes the delivery of, by any means, including electronic, of letters, telegrams, messages, packages, through assisted devices for people with vision impairments or hearing loss, or any communication made through any available technologies or any other objects. So I believe that is the portion specifically that was stricken down. My understanding is the rest of it stands right now. And I know that in the bill draft that we have in front of us, one of the things that they mentioned as well is that there was not intent. So there wasn't an intent to harass in our current statutes. So that was problematic. And I realize that it fixes that, but I just thought I'd get that on the public record before we have nonpartisan research answer the last question, if we could.
And if Mr. Johnson is not ready, we can certainly move over to Representative Mueller for the sake of time and then come back. So why don't we do that? Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And when we discussed this bill in committee on March 4th, I was able to describe a case that I had as a prosecutor where it was a different provision than the one that was struck by the Supreme Court case. And if I'm remembering right, there was also a subsequent Court of Appeals case that has come out since then using that same rationale from the AGB case to strike another provision in the statute. And the case I had was a case of sexual assault, domestic violence, and stalking. And the defendant ended up pleading guilty to stalking under one of these provisions for sending a number of threatening text messages. And there's a number of reasons why they had a plea agreement to that. But often in these kinds of cases, that's the best evidence you're going to have in a case. When you've got emails or text messages, something like that, you're going to have really, really good solid evidence that the person was participating in that kind of activity. So the defendant in that case ended up pleading guilty. I got the case on appeal. And when I got it, I realized that we had AJB and these other, at least one other Court of Appeals case striking this as unconstitutional. And ultimately, we had to concede that that guilty plea couldn't stand anymore because the statute had been struck. Because of the way the Supreme Court in that case talked about the language of the bill, there was really no way to save a number of these provisions. And, you know, I have a question to Mr. Chair for the testifiers here. You know, in thinking about this now, even compared to March 4th, when we heard this before, the kinds of behaviors that we're looking at for stalking, like emailing and texting and phone calling, these behaviors, I think, have a chance of really increasing in light of COVID now and the fact that people are sheltering in place. And I'm just wondering if our testifiers can address that issue.
If they could quickly, that'd be great. Ms. Richards or Ms. Roller?
Chair Mariani, members of the committee, while we certainly share some of those concerns, I don't have any specifics at this point to say we've seen an increase in this specific type of behavior. But I certainly think that when we see an increase of domestic and sexual violence behaviors, it's typically across the full spectrum of the ways in which people use to abuse. And so I would certainly expect that we would see an increase in the use of technology and these specific means of harassment and stalking. I just don't have any specifics I could offer you at this point.
Ms. Richards, it certainly does seem to me that, you know, what Representative Mueller shared in terms of seeing another case that arose after the Supreme Court's decision to strike down this particular language that Representative Mueller as a prosecutor wasn't able to pursue justice in that matter. And so to me that lines up with your overall concern that you shared at the very beginning when this question was first posed to you that that we may be going through a period of time disarmed in terms of being able to address this kind of behavior effectively. Representative Mueller, are you done? All right, very well. Representative Nash and Johnson, then we'll circle back to O'Neill, and then members, I'm going to move forward with the rest of the bill. Representative Nash.
Mr. Speaker, go ahead and take me off the list.
Okay, thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Johnson.
I was never on the list.
Okay, Representative O'Neill, I'll let you have the. I don't know that Mr. Johnson has information yet. Let me check really quick if he does.
And Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I had something that I've noticed that may be responsive to Representative O'Neill's earlier question that maybe Mr. Johnson can verify for us.
Yeah.
If you have just to say that my understanding here is that the Supreme Court case we're referencing was from June of 2019 and did strike down that one clause, number 6, Representative O'Neill's referencing. But then in December, as Representative Mueller mentioned, another clause, clause 4, I believe, was struck down by the Court of Appeals. So we're sort of on a track here. It's almost like the pandemic. I hate to analogize to it. We're like we're now having court opinions coming out striking down different parts of our statute. So we're actually up to two parts of our stalking statute have been struck down already. And the danger is that more can be struck down. So just that's my understanding of the timing. Mr. Johnson, please correct me, of course.
Well, and the courts work the way the courts should be working, right? And obviously that means that we as a legislature should be working, with the same speed, I would argue, and attention to the issue. Representative Johnson, Mr. Johnson, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, members, I'll note that Representative Pinto is correct. There was a Court of Appeals decision that struck down another portion of the statute. Representative O'Neill had asked about the timing of this. I have not been able to locate exactly when the original case was filed. The incident that led to the conviction and started this did take place in 2016. The Court of Appeals opinion in this case was issued April 9th, 2018, and the date of the Supreme Court opinion is June 19, 2019. I believe that answers the questions that were out there.
Okay. Ms. Roller asked to be recognized on this. Ms. Roller?
Yes, Chair, thank you. I'm going back to the question about technology. And the Center for Missing Children state that they do not have a case of a child that had not been sexually assaulted that did not involve some type of technology via grooming through social media, text messaging, or exploiting the child via pornography on the internet. So in lieu of that insight is that those things are very important in our stalking and harassment cases, and then moving forward with continuous sexual assault or sexual exploitation of children.
The stakes are certainly high, members. Representative O'Neill, I'll let you have a last few seconds, then we're gonna move on, unless you're okay for now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I had actually quite a few additional comments to make, but I realize that this is only before us as an informational hearing.
Yes.
So something that not only concerned me, and I do thank Representative Pinto for making that recommendation of the change of, I believe it's the A-10. There's something else that was concerning to me, and that was because we're talking about a gross misdemeanor, and because the gross misdemeanor portion of this statute does tie back to 624.713, which is the prohibited person for purchasing a firearm. There is a phrase that's used throughout this new language that says causes, attempts to cause, or would reasonably be expected to cause substantially emotional distress. And that comes after the first two components, which say fear of substantial bodily harm for themselves or fear of substantial bodily harm for a family member or household member. And my concern is it's inconsistent. So if the victim has to express fear in one and two, they don't have to express any emotional distress in section three, where it says that causes emotional distress or attempts to cause or would reasonably be expected to cause substantially emotional distress. That seems inconsistent to me, and I think it's important that the victim actually express that they have fear or that they have emotional distress. And I would point out that substantial emotional distress doesn't have a statutory definition. Either I'm told not in our state statutes nor in federal statutes. So that's a little bit ambiguous, but you can find that phrasing on page 6, line 7, and on page 8, there's three different references. Now, I would say that on page 8, that's for misdemeanors, but it's incredibly problematic, I think, to have something that's so subjective. Literally, the victim doesn't even have to say that I had emotional distress of any type. It would just be reasonable to think she might or could or did. To me, that seems problematic when you couple that with that now is a gross misdemeanor, and it's also now you've become a prohibited person. So I would like to point that out, and I still find that problematic in this new language.
All right. Very well, members. So we have that on the record, and this is a conversation that will continue. If there's still time in the end, we can circle back. Representative O'Neill, I think you mentioned you had a couple of other issues you wanted to get out on the table. But at this point, I really do want to move forward. We have Chief Potts, Sheriff Leslie, Mr. Peters on deck, and we've had them taking swinging practices for quite a while there. Ms. Roller and Ms. Richards, I want to thank you for your participation in today's conversation. But more importantly, I want to thank you for the work that you do to help keep Minnesota safe. The principle that you put on the table that, you know, during this period of time of COVID, as daunting and as threatening as it is, certainly is not a period of time in which we want to back off of promoting practices that help keep the public safe. Representative Pendleton, you had something very quickly?
I'm just asking, Mr. Chair, if those testifiers will still be available for discussion as other points are bring up. I know this language was a high priority for the advocates for victims and survivors, and just want to make sure in case other issues come up that they might be available to address those concerns.
If there's still time, that certainly will be the case, and I'll ask our committee administrator to communicate with those in the waiting room to see about their ongoing availability. So with that, thank you, Ms. Roller and Ms. Richards. We're going to make the switch over to the second part, which is a presentation by several individuals and groups from our local law enforcement community on COVID effects on local law enforcement. We've got one provision in the bill that speaks to that. So with that, let's see if we can do a good transition with the technology here. I think we're going to try to get all together, Chief Potts, Sheriff Leslie, and Mr. Peters up on our screens here.
Mr. Chair Mariani, this is Chief Jeff Potts. I think I have the system up and running.
Yes, you do. Good to see you, Chief.
It's good to see you too, sir.
Let's see if your colleagues are able to join in here. I assume we were going to do all three at the same time, but I might be wrong about that.
Mr. Chair, I have two or three items just to go over fairly quickly, and then I think Sheriff Leslie was going to get into a couple others, and if you'd like, I could start with those, and then we can turn it over to Sheriff Leslie when he is able to get online.
Why don't we do that? Thank you, Chief.
Sure. Thank you, Chair and members. Just kind of to recap some of the issues that the law enforcement community are seeing. And when I say law enforcement, I'm going to also include kind of the first responder community, police and fire, obviously are responding to the medical situations across the state. In from a, more specifically on the law enforcement, I think the anecdotally we've seen an uptick in the domestics, as was just mentioned by the previous testifiers. Some of our calls for services are down. Others seem to be like domestics have kind of seen an uptick. Mental health calls have seen a bit of an uptick in the last 2 weeks to 3 weeks. But I'm going to focus more on some of the issues specifically related to the COVID-19 calls. So break it down into three categories: PPE, location information on COVID-19 positive cases, and then priority testing for first responders. These three items are somewhat interrelated. First, on the PPE front, we're hearing as recently as this morning on a conference call with regional reps all across the state that law enforcement agencies are really, really running down on PPE. And when I mention PPE, when I say PPE, what I'm including are the N95 masks, gloves, glasses or goggles, some type of eye protection, and gowns. We have started doing some inventories across the state. Many agencies are down to just a very, very few N95 masks, and some agencies actually have zero N95 masks, yet they're still getting calls for services or calls for service to locations where COVID-19 might be present. N95 masks are obviously a big concern. Gowns, we did an inventory throughout the state of 165 or so responses. Over 80 of those departments have zero gowns. And so this kind of plays into the next area, which is the location information for COVID-19 positive cases. It is our hope that the Department of Health will allow those locations to be shared with first responders, police, fire, and this is the reason, and that is when you have the severe reduction of PPE, and we're telling our agencies to ration that out very smartly so that will last. When we get called to a scene where we don't know if there's COVID-19 present or not, they're obviously wearing eye protection, N95 masks if they have them, and gloves. But the officers are going in there and, again, trying to ration that PPE out and hopefully making it last as long as possible. If they were to know that there is a COVID-19 case, they would also don a gown. And that gives you the most protection. We've seen video of what is going on in hospital ER rooms across the country. And when you walk into a hospital ER room, you're seeing not only N95 masks, goggles, and gloves, but gowns. We think it's important to try to protect the first responders. If we can share the information with the first responders where we have known cases, we're not looking for the name of the individual, just the addresses, that they'll be able to wear the appropriate PPE in on the cases where they know that there is a COVID-19 positive case, but also more importantly, they'll be able to ration it so that they can preserve it and hopefully last a little bit longer. At the burn rate we're seeing right now, some of these agencies just they're not gonna have PPE if we can't get stuff delivered to them in the next couple of weeks. And so for that reason, in many of our agencies across the state, 60% of the law enforcement agencies across the state are 10 or fewer officers. 35 to 40% of them are 5 or fewer. And what that means is if we can't properly protect the first responders to prevent spread, not only spread within the community, but spread within the law enforcement agency, many of these agencies with one or two cases of COVID internally would literally have to shut down their operation. And again, that's why we think the ability to share the information is very important. It also plays into the issue of priority testing for first responders. Now, we see that that is included in what your bill includes today. We think that's important because one case down, kind of anecdotally, what we've heard is there's an officer, happens to be a chief down in an agency in Southwest Minnesota, was symptomatic for 7 days. Not able to get a test. Now he did self-quarantine. There's some information or evidence that some of the COVID-19 can be contagious, pre-symptomatic. We think it's important for these folks who have been exposed to cases in their communities to be able to get priority testing to again, slow the spread within their community, also slow or eliminate the spread within their agency. And the sooner they can get testing to confirm that, we think would be a big help to the first responder community. So that's kind of a recap on those three topics. The PPE, there's no legislative ask, I think, at this point. The location information on COVID positive cases, we think that would be very, very important to our first responders to be able to know where those cases are, similar to what MDH has now done with congregate care facilities. And the last item is the priority testing. I think we appreciate the fact that that's in your proposal at this point, because it is very important for us in terms of how we try to slow the spread of this virus throughout our community and more importantly through our agencies. And with that, if we have Sheriff Leslie, I will yield to him to bring forward a couple of other items.
And Chief Potts, just very, very quickly. I've just learned a few, a couple of new things in your quick testimony here. Congregate care currently is using some kind of location information access or authority.
Mr. Chair, what I was referring to in that comment was over the weekend, I think late last week, Department of Health released the names of the congregate care facilities where there is known to have been a outbreak of COVID-19. Prior to last week, that was not occurring. And so similar to that, I think what we're asking for is there be the ability to share the information of the locations where MDH is aware of a COVID positive case so that we can alert the first responders going to that address so that they can wear the appropriate PPE.
Okay, very well. Thank you. And you have the sheriff there?
I'm here.
There he is.
Start my video. There it is. Are you seeing me now?
I certainly do, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Not to jump on the Jeff Potts bandwagon, but we do strongly support Section 9 of the bill and want to get first responders up towards the front of the line. I really appreciate that. Section 1, which would require local correctional facilities to have data on their website, reference population, we do that immediately. We already have inmate search capabilities on our website, so that would not be much of a move for us. I just want to basically go over a few things that Minnesota sheriffs have been doing, as well as the Dakota County Sheriff's Office.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Correctional staff were instrumental in helping get this going. There's about 80 actions we took immediately and within the first couple of weeks. This isn't meant to be a show and tell, but we wanted to paint a picture of the efforts we've done to make sure that only people that need to come to jail are coming to jail at this time. We work closely with our local police chiefs across Dakota County and the state. We've placed all our non-essential staff out of the facility into pop-up offices from across the sheriff's office. We received a variance from the Department of Corrections to suspend in-person professional visits and move those to a video visitation model with computer screens, et cetera. But I think the biggest thing we did was do the relationships we have with our justice stakeholders, judges, prosecutors, community corrections. We talked with them and met periodically to identify the most amenable to sentence modifications to get them out of our jail. This included work release and sentence to serve folks. They already leave the facility on a daily basis to take jobs or community work service opportunities. We transitioned them to electronic home monitoring, for example. In addition, we obtained two judicial orders from our first judicial district, Judge Catherine Meserick, the chief judge. She suspended inmate sentence to serve programming and inmate work release. This was done, again, to restrict the inmates from coming and going into the jail, which is where the greatest potential for infection occurs. We added an additional in-custody courtroom afternoon calendar to establish and review motions for bail modification or releases from custody. We granted authority to community corrections in the jail to extend jail report dates until further notice. So an individual gets sentenced and then told to report into the jail in a week or two. We've moved those out into June and July, and we can, again, look at those as need be. The second judicial order allowed the sheriff to release arrestees with warrants in other jails across the state. This applies to all offenses misdemeanor related that are non-person crimes. Another jail would contact us, advise us that they have somebody in their custody with a Dakota County warrant. We would advise them that person needs to be released with a new court date. It saves all that transport time and all those booking of offenders that really don't need to be in our facilities. Officers on the street can do that as well. This would not include warrants issued for domestic abuse related offenses, including restraining orders, domestic abuse no contact orders, or harassment orders. So I think the key there was the fact we had a great relationship with the criminal justice stakeholders, but operationally we've made a lot of changes as well. All our jail roll calls are conducted through Skype from the assigned post within the jail. All incoming mail for inmates is given a 24-hour stay-at-home order if they aren't allowed to have their mail for 24 hours. All inmate housing units, we've consolidated two of them. We don't allow, of course, the most serious offenders to be with the gross misdemeanor offenders. We've implemented single cell use when we can to avoid any kind of double bunking operation. Our modifications to arrestee intake as well. When you arrive into the jail, all our inmates are asked to wear a mask, as well as the staff. If we see any symptoms, we put them in quarantine, or we put them in a zero pressure cell, and then we monitor them with our 24/7 nursing folks. We've also had ongoing discussions and opportunities with other jail facilities, in particular Carver, Scott, and Washington County, about the opportunity to consolidate operations should our staff get sick. Thank you. That has not happened. The numbers in Dakota County, our jail, We average about 230.
That's what we
heard about it. We're down to 97 today. On my way here today, I talked to Hutch, the sheriff in Hennepin. They're at 850 a month ago. They're at 501. So again, we are seeing significant numbers go down.
Okay.
There is some bad news. Our jails continue to process inmates, people coming and going, which places our staff at risk. For example, the week of March 16th, Hennepin had 450 bookings that week and 642 releases. So you have that door, that rotating door of people coming and going. And then we have been alerted as well to an increase in arrests for domestic abuse, which is sad to see. Yesterday, I got a report that of the 11 arrests over the Saturday night 24-hour period in the Dakota County Jail, seven were for domestic assault. The week prior, March 28th, six of nine were for domestic assault. I worried that that was not was just an aberration. So we looked back 3 months, December of 19. What happened that Saturday night? 21 arrests that night, only three for domestic assault. So we are seeing an increase, unfortunately, which is sad. But we will continue to work and support the people we have in our jail. We continue to work and support our customers in the community and the inmates that come into our jail, as well as the correctional deputies that work for us. I'll stand for any questions, Mr. Chair.
Sheriff, thank you for a very concise walkthrough and not at all a show and tell. I mean, I think it's absolutely critically important that the public maintain its confidence in you and in your fellow sheriffs and local law enforcement, that involves that they are powerfully informed about how you are taking all this incredibly seriously and doing all sorts of alternative and new planning in order to protect not only yourselves but to protect the public as well. I really appreciate the sharing of data. It really speaks to the importance of having long-term tracking of data so that we can pick up on patterns and trends, et cetera. And part of that data, of course, is, reflecting some of the concerns that we just heard prior from Violence-Free Minnesota and Minkasa in terms of what we could, unfortunately expect, to unfold here. So let me stop there because I think we still have Mr. Peters, I hope, and then we'll open up to questions for the three of you. Is Mr. Peters there? Okay, I'm being told that we don't have him at this time. So let me do this. Let me just very quickly talk about a couple of amendments here. And again, members, an amendment is by language because we're not formally moving anything, but it's really about making sure we're very transparent about language in addition to what's in the draft bill. So I'll do this very quickly. There's the 8-7 amendment, which would be my amendment. And let me just pull it up quickly. Yes, the 8-7 amendment, it's actually very, it's quite simple. As both the sheriff and the chief spoke to in regards to one of their priority requests, which has to do with quick notification relative to testing for our first responders. We did check with the Minnesota Department of Health to make sure a couple of things. And one of the things was to make sure we were using the appropriate language. And so this amendment basically just does a technical correction. And I didn't even know this, folks, that replaces COVID-19 with SARS-CoV-2. That must be the epidemiological, scientific appropriate description. But I have to say that in checking with the Department of Health over, just asking them about our language, other than that, they expressed no concern with the language in the bill, and they were primarily looking at the language about notifying our law enforcement and other first responders. So that's the A7 amendment. The A5 amendment is a the A5 amendment falls within the Department of Public Safety, so that's why I brought it up at this point. And this has to do with YIPA grants and youth intervention program grants. And this was actually a provision that Senator Limmer spoke to me about. We chatted yesterday afternoon about this. And the issue here is that it's difficult, and we heard this from the advocates prior to this, difficult to fundraise during this period of time, and yet fundraising, there's a fundraising match requirement for these programs in order to access state grants. And so they're at risk of losing half of their expected revenues at this time of year when they should be doing powerful outreach with at-risk youth. We'll discuss this further in terms of, the need for an emergency, response, if you will. I kind of tend to think of this as pretty easy, kind of low-hanging fruit type of work that we could do, where there really shouldn't be much of a disagreement among us relative to this issue. However, I do want to point out, as I pointed out to Senator Limmer, that as important as this is, there are much bigger, frankly, things, like, for instance, the testing of our law enforcement and first responders. And so for me, part of being able to offer this amendment for discussion exposure is, demonstrating my good faith effort that both our Senate and House leaders are expecting of us in terms of how we process ideas together and move quickly and efficiently toward some good intermediate important COVID response bills. And then with that, there was an A3 amendment, but my understanding, and I think, by the way, Chair Lesh has joined us, so I just want to note that for the record, because we did do a roll call, Chair Lesh, because we have to. but I just want to make sure that you are recorded present, that my understanding is the A3 amendment at this point does not have movement going forward, so I don't think we need to get into it at this point. So with that, then I'm going to stop and circle back to both the chief and the sheriff for members' questions. And I believe right off the bat we have Representative Johnson, followed by Representative Lemieux. Representative Johnson.
Good morning or afternoon, or it's been so long since we started, I can't remember what day it is.
Yeah, no kidding.
What I wanted to talk about a little bit, one of the sheriffs brought up, is letting the law enforcement, the first responders, especially our fire department personnel and our law enforcement, access to where that virus is. I've been working with Senator Limmer, and we've learned, and we've already sent a letter to the Commissioner of Health. We learned that she does have the authority right now to allow that, and that not so much as the individual, but the address. So when there's a medical call or some type of call, that can pop up, that it's there. So especially a medical situation, I have one of my fire departments that runs medicals. We have a 14-man department. If six go in there, that we now have an 8-man department because four of them are quarantined for 2 weeks. That information has to get out because it's a severe public safety hazard. If we wipe out all these fire departments, especially in greater Minnesota, and 90% of our firefighters are volunteer, it's going to be a very dangerous public safety issue. In fact, I just saw the other day, I had a fire right down the street from me. But if our firefighters are in quarantine, there's going to be nobody to put the fires out. So we need to work on something. We believe she has the authority to do this now. I'm hoping that the commissioner will, so we don't have to get involved in it, but the sheriffs and stuff could actually push a little more at the department to get that information out, at least an address, so you know if it's an apartment building, you go in that apartment building, you know you need your PPEs because there's somebody that's positive in that at that address.
And I'm sorry, Representative Johnson, do you want the chief or the sheriff to respond to, it sounds like you're basically encouraging them to work closely with the Department of Health at this point.
That is correct. Work with them and try to get that information out. We believe, and like I said, talking with Senator Limmer, we've sent a letter to her expressing that we believe that she does have that authority, and it would have to be kept confidential, just like under all the other Chapter 13 issues. But on these health issues, she does have that authority to give that information out now.
Well, Representative Johnson, I'm glad you had the conversation with Senator Limmer. I chatted with him yesterday, and this did not come up on his end. So it's good to hear that he's following up with you, at least relative to this issue. I think Chapter 13 was one of the primary things that we were concerned with, because typically, my understanding is typically it would require legislative action to at least temporarily waive Chapter 13 requirements, such as how serious the state, has tended to data privacy issues. And after that, it gets incredibly technically complex for me, particularly as it interacts with federal data privacy protections. It does seem to me that, and I certainly would, Chief Potts or Sheriff Leslie wish to respond or not, but it does seem to me that there certainly would be, at the very least, no harm if we acted and gave, our okay relative to this. Part of what I'm operating from, and this is for all the members, is that I do think that one of the primary responsibilities of any legislative body and any legislator, quite frankly, is to make sure that the executive branch stays within the checks and bounds, philosophy and approach to American governance. And so that means that we should avail ourselves of our opportunity to speak and not just count on the executive branch to do what it needs to do, quite frankly. And it sounds like this is probably one of those areas in order to, promote public safety and the safety of our first responders and law enforcement. So I would certainly encourage us to speak if we can. I think where we're strongly in agreement is that I think our law enforcement and our first responders should be able to have this reassurance from all of us relative to the rapid information that they need in order to do their work well and be protected. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to speak to the A5 about the match for YIPA. And I think that this is probably a good juncture to put on the public record that we are going to be facing deficits when we come back. Before we got into session, or maybe in the middle of session, I should say, we had a projected surplus. I guarantee you that is gone. And we will probably come back to deficits. How big? I don't think anybody knows. But I was actually I was leadership staff in the Senate back in 2000, started in 10, 11, and 12. And of course, you remember back in 2011, we had a $6.5 billion deficit in the November forecast and a $5.5 billion deficit in the February forecast that had to be dealt with. And I believe we are in times that are probably worse than that. So I think it bears a conversation here to say, I think we need to start talking about places where we can save money, and it's going to be tough for everybody, but I just wanted to put that on that the public record in regards to the A5 over still talking about doing grant programs, and not only that, but allowing them to move forward outside of the parameters that we've already set in legislation. So I would say I don't know that this is the right time to talk about that. I think that we are going to be facing pretty big deficits when we come back with the next forecast. So for that reason, I would oppose the A5.
Yeah, thank you, Representative O'Neill. Certainly noted. I think for any of us who are going to be returning, hopefully returning next year, we're going to have a real difficult time. I think there's agreement on that. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that our economy is suffering tremendously, and that probably is not going to alleviate anytime soon. The A5 amendment is offered in good faith in terms of, you know, what comes forward from groups that we've supported, and that frankly doesn't require us to spend more money as much as it requires us to waive a matching requirement on their part. And again, this was a provision that Senator Limmer, pretty early floated by. And if it helps us to get to a place of moving quickly, I certainly want to be able to do that. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And I support the A5. I actually just want to take this moment, though, to Sheriff Leslie. I'm wondering if you can give us an update about how youth facilities are working in terms of safety for staff, but also safety for youth.
Sheriff.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Dakota County doesn't manage the juvenile center, so I don't have a firsthand knowledge of what goes on there. That's managed by Community Services, a different division in county government. But from what I hear from sheriffs across the state is they're doing some of the similar modeling and protocols as they do in the jail, and trying to keep as many of the youth out of the juvenile centers as they can. Their best home with their families, unless, of course, they're a danger. And then that's when, make that decision to place them somewhere just to maybe cool off for the night, or hopefully look upon things a little differently in the morning kind of deal. But I don't have any firsthand knowledge. I can do a quick survey if you'd like.
Thank you, Sheriff. That'd be great if you wouldn't mind emailing I'm sure the entire committee is interested in that. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Okay, very well. Then we have Representative Lesh. Chair Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I originally went on to speak to the A3 when you brought that up, and in this environment, it's difficult to weigh in and do the to that point thing, but before we get into that, you did bring up the attendance piece. I was at the meeting at the beginning, and then had to step out to do another meeting for 25 minutes, and so rejoined at this point. I just wanted to clarify that. So thank you.
Got that on the record. Thank you, Chair Lesh.
Thank you. To the A3, Mr. Chair, yes. This is something I've attempted to work with Chair Limmer on. It is the subject matter of it, the driver's licenses. Is something that was in Omnibus Prime 2 years ago, and everyone agreed to and voted on it. And further, it is something to which we came near close agreement to on in our conference committee last year. So I thought it would make sense. It is still my hope to reach some level of agreement on that. I know that, there are portions of it that not everyone is happy with, but, politics is the art of compromise. So it's my hope that we could arrive at some compromise on this. We are going to have to get some real results on how we're dealing with driver's licenses in the face of a pandemic. So it will come up again. I'm not going to speak to it today because of the promise that I made to Chair Limmer that I would not offer it without joint agreement, but it's my hope that members of this committee can arrive at some some comity on this. Thank you for giving me the time to speak to it on that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your longstanding commitment to this policy as well. And hopefully we can yet still act before we go sine-die in this session. Thank you. Representative Kunstler, you have the last question in this section.
Actually, I don't have a question so much as a comment. I have some concerns with the provision that is telling the fire departments and things that they are getting the correct addresses of places that have COVID-19. Given how few tests we've been able to do and the pronouncements every day that there are far more cases that are untested than are tested, I do not want them going in with a false sense of security that they know for sure that they're going into a place that doesn't have COVID-19. So if we're going to pass those out, the addresses through the Department of Health, it needs to come with a warning that they should still be taking the precautions because we're not sure that the place doesn't have it, even though they haven't tested positive. We need to protect these people and not give them a false sense of security that we have a comprehensive list of where COVID-19 is currently residing. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Considine. Well, and so that is going to end this particular part. Good conversation. Again, I want to thank you for the discussion here. I am, Representative Valdez, I am indeed struck by the budget challenge that our state faces, absolutely. You know, my understanding is the governor is applying for federal aid and has just recently done that. So I think it reflects, you know, a responsible action that in turn, you know, acknowledges, you know, the structural challenges that our state, and I suspect 49 other states are also going to be facing here. And so a lot of tough decisions to come, folks, in terms of, you know, how do we maintain public safety in the midst of some real, perhaps unprecedented budgetary realities and challenges. Chief Potts and Sheriff, I want to thank you for the work that you do, Sheriff Leslie and Chief Potts, and for taking the time out to inform us today. You're doing stellar work. You have our confidence, and we look forward to maintaining a close communication with you so that we can constantly look for ways to better arm and equip you as you do the important work of keeping all Minnesotans safe. So thank you for your time here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, members, we're going to shift into the third and final piece, and we are obviously behind, but it's okay. I mean, we're having a necessary good conversation. So this third piece is the corrections piece, we're going to have a presentation from our corrections ombudsperson. As you all recall, we recreated that institution. We were the first in the nation to have it several decades ago. We lost it during budgetary crisis times. And I'm real pleased that Chair Considine carried a bill forward and were able to recreate this office and that enjoyed good bipartisan support. The point of the office is not to be partisan. It's, in fact, to be independent and autonomous so that it can speak the things that we need to hear in order to make sure that we're operating a corrections sector that reflects the best of our respect for human dignity and values, but that also is effective in terms of promoting public safety. So with that, I'm gonna ask Mr. Mark Hossie, the ombudsperson for corrections, to come forward and share his presentation. I think Mr. Hossie has a PowerPoint. I'm not sure, but we'll find out here in a second.
All right, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members.
Good afternoon.
Are you seeing me? Well, yes. Hearing
me? I see.
You see me, okay. Thank you. Thanks for having me this afternoon.
No problem.
Siri just responded to me. Right
about that. Don't you hate that?
All right, get used to the technology here. So as you said, Mr. Chair, I'm Mark Hazy. I'm the ombudsperson for corrections for the state of Minnesota. I'm using the shorter term ombuds for corrections. I'm gonna share my PowerPoint here.
Good luck.
Yeah, well, I thought I had it all set. Here, I gotta look at all windows.
Looking good.
Start the slideshow. All right, you're seeing that?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
We are, yes.
All right, thank you. So, as the chair noted, the office is new, so I wanted to give you just a little bit of background information to refresh your memory. And just a note, I have quite a few slides in this deck. There'll be a number I go through really quickly. I just wanted you to have the information you can refer to later, but I'll go through quickly to focus on the the most important and relevant parts for today. The statute for the Ombuds Office creates an independent investigative authority, which with the goal of promoting the highest attainable standards of competence, efficiency, and justice in the administration of corrections. Jurisdiction includes the Department of Corrections and local facilities licensed by the department. I wanted to point out one part of the statute that requires me, if I believe a statute produces results that are objectionable, that I bring that to the attention of you all and the governor, and that's what brings me here today. Just a little bit about the status of the office before COVID-19. Skip by that pretty quick. I can always answer questions about that later. A little bit about the status of the office. Since the COVID-19 response, one thing I want to note is that I've been meeting with Commissioner Schnell pretty frequently, and I want to thank him and his staff for their making themselves available. They're incredibly busy, working incredibly hard, and they've just been had a real been very transparent and forthcoming with information when it's needed. So I want to start out with a little bit about the importance of the corrections response to a pandemic like this, to COVID-19. There are a lot of reasons that our response is critical to the health of inmates, of staff, and the community. Probably the most is the close quarters involved in correctional facilities. Many of you are personally aware of this. If not all of you, have probably visited a correctional facility in Minnesota. This picture shows one of your visits, I think. I recognize a couple people there, maybe. There's probably no other condition that people live in that are, where your entire life, every aspect of it is done in such close quarters. And what the CDC here is calling congregate environments. And some might ask, could we just do lockdowns as long as needed? Well, one response I'd have for that is a lockdown is not necessarily going to solve everything, because there's still things that need to be done, getting food in and out to people, healthcare, showering. I mean, some cells don't have showers and water, so there's still going to have to be some movement. And even if it would help, to put people in lockdown for what could be long periods of time, I would argue, constitutes cruel treatment. And it would also require sustained staff as well to maintain that kind of environment. Another important aspect of correctional facilities is the disparately vulnerable nature, because of the disparate number of percentage of them that have underlying conditions that have been shown to be make somebody more vulnerable to COVID-19. For example, high blood pressure and hypertension within prisons is 26% of the population. It's only 18% in the U.S. population. And that, you know, is true of pretty much every one of these underlying conditions. Another important consideration is the health of surrounding communities. There's movement into and out of prisons and jails on a constant basis. Sometimes that's referred to as churn. In jails, of course, that happens more on the side of the inmates because of the shorter sentences. But in prisons, it's constantly happening daily. Hundreds and hundreds of staff are going in and out of the facilities, and they're going from the facilities to their families and communities. And that puts their families and their communities at heightened risk as well. Also, there's no intensive care facilities in our state prisons. So if somebody requires that care, they're going to have to go into the local health facilities. And, you know, we know that those are likely to be already very strained in both urban and potentially particularly rural communities. Additionally, you know, people are in prison on our behalf, and that creates a special legal and moral obligation to care for them. I'd also note that, you know, staff are put there in very difficult circumstances. It's a difficult job, and we have an obligation to make sure that the conditions are safe, you know, safe for them as possible as well. So the question we face and the question that states around the country and people around the world are asking is, what does this kind of legal and moral obligation look like during a pandemic like the one we're facing? I would say there's two broad categories of types of responses. One is an operational response. Sheriff Leslie spoke about this a little bit at the local level. You know, this is limiting visitors, testing, sanitation, adjusting activities. And I know that the Department of Corrections has been, you know, has swiftly and comprehensively move to this kind of response. You know, I don't have a great window into how it's getting down to the lowest levels if we're concerned about that, but I think that's going to be understandable as they adjust to this and as directives get down to the lowest levels and they get this all sorted out in this very fluid environment. So I'm not going to, I think the commissioner is going to be available later, so I hope he can ask, you know, answer questions about the operational response if people have those. I could do my best there, but I'm not going to cover it in my presentation. The other large type, main type of response is a population reduction, both in and out, and that can help, you know, as Sheriff Leslie spoke about, can help with all those other operational responses and make those more effective and more possible. So I'm going to talk about the local correctional population response, what I know, what I've the data that I've gathered. This graph shows a few sample counties, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Anoka, and then to the far right is the combined correctional population of the nine of the 10 largest counties in the state. And you can see that in the 3 weeks of March, the population has gone down drastically. This represents about a 39%. And here are the raw numbers. You can see 61% at the bottom right, that represents a 39% reduction in the overall population. And you can see that ranges from, you know, 25% in the Hennepin and Wright County, the Wright County jail, and 25% reduction in the Hennepin County adult, the workhouse, to as much as, if you look at the Anoka workhouse as of this date, they were down 72%. And also, Sheriff Leslie spoke about Dakota now is down to 97 in their jail. I had that at 114. So, you know, the sheriff spoke about sheriffs, prosecutors, judges, defense attorneys all working together to make this happen because they saw the need to create these reductions and to limit the back and forth between from the facilities. And I think that, you know, is evidence of the type of support that there is for doing this type of measure. And you know, I think it's very, I'm very impressed with what has been done at the local level on this. Now, moving on to the state corrections population response. Just quickly before I get into the population numbers. This is the status of testing and confirmed cases as of this morning. 30 tests have been completed and 7 confirmed positive, all those at Moose Lake. And there's at least one, at least this is inmates. I know there's at least one staff member at Red Wing that tested positive. This is the state population changes from 1 January to 5 April. And that represents a reduction of 16 adults out of our almost 9,000 in the state that it's gone down. I want to talk a little bit about what's happening in other jurisdictions. In England, you see I've highlighted here that about 8,000 prison staff have been absent due to COVID-19, and that's about a quarter of the total workforce. I think that's something that has to be kept in mind. They're also releasing prisoners early. States have done a number of different things. These are all things that have been done to release people early through existing authority. Iowa, 700 prisoners early release. Illinois, 500. California, estimated 3,500. Some governors have also worked to reduce the population through executive order, particularly suspending intake into state facilities. And then the Kentucky governor has done commuted sentences, and their department is also releasing more people. I wanted to spend a little more time on the federal response because I think it's a good model of the legislative branch working with the executive branch. In the recent stimulus bill that Congress passed, that made it easier to release more inmates into home confinement. Prior to that, only inmates who had already served at least 90% of their sentence or had no more than 6 months left to go could be released to home confinement. And that legislation got rid of that requirement. And just this last Friday, Attorney General Barr directed the Bureau of Prisons to find suitable candidates for home confinement and immediately process them for transfer and transfer them to home confinement following a 14-day quarantine. He also noted that if electronic monitoring is not available, not absolutely necessary, then it wouldn't be required. So like I said, that I think that's a model of a legislative branch giving the executive some discretion in this area. I'm going to move on to my recommendations. First, I sent a letter on March 24th to you all, the governor and the chief justice, really with some ideas. I'm just going to kind of skip through those because that was just to try to get people thinking about the issues. More of it was focused on the local level that I'm currently focusing on. My current recommendation my finding, my belief is that current statutes likely don't give or may not give the commissioner enough authority, enough discretion to release enough people early to make the population small enough to adequately manage it for the situation. And I think the most important and urgent action right now is to give him some of that authority. Do I know with 100% certainty that this is what must be done? I can't really say that, but it is my belief that it should be done. It's important, but of course it's your place. It's your decision whether or not this is acted upon or not. The commissioner does have some authority to release people early and to limit intakes under current law, and I know that he's taken some steps to do this. I expect that those numbers in the state prisons are going to go down really soon here because I know that he's looking at people who are eligible for work release under current statutes and also looking at his options under medical furlough statutes. And he's directed hearing officers to only revoke supervised release if there's a finding of dangerousness. So that's limited those incoming admits. There is a statute, I'll go through this kind of quick because I'd like to get more to the legislation. My suggestion was to amend the statute that currently allows for the commissioner to move inmates, remove them from facilities in an epidemic. I don't believe it gives him, and he doesn't need enough discretion to respond to the current situation where you have a highly contagious potentially lethal virus that's spreading quickly, not only in all of the facilities, but also in the broader community simultaneously. My suggestion was to amend that to give the commissioner not only authority to release people within 180 days of the end of their normal sentence, but also to limit intake. And in the current legislation, I know that you've included this a different version of the 180 days, up to 180 days early release. And you know, I think the way that it's crafted in this, in the language before you is a good way to do it. It's a little less, it's you know, the legislation you're working on is more temporary. This would be more of an ongoing permanent solution when there's this type of an issue. And that's the main difference. So this, you've already heard about section one, public access to correctional facility population data. I was glad to hear that. You know, Sheriff Leslie thought that would be easy to implement. I think this is good not just for the public to know, but and to get this information easily, but public officials like county commissioners, I think, should be able to track this. And what I found, you know, in collecting this data is that it's not easy to find currently. Section 8 is the temporary emergency powers provision. In that, you know, similar to same as my recommendation to give the commissioner authority to release people up to 180 days prior to their normal release date. I want to point out, I have highlighted here that, you know, this requires him to determine that that person is low risk to reoffend and does not present a foreseeable risk to public safety. You know, and it also requires a process to be followed for people to be released. One thing I want to point out about this language you have is, you know, it's not an automatic release. It requires the people who are trained to do risk assessments to assess the cases, make sure that there's a safe place for them to go, and then release people based on those factors. And I think those are the things that really should be considered and give the flexibility that's needed. There was one other. Oh, I also just wanted to note, I didn't have a slide on this, but as mentioned earlier, the free telephone and video conferencing provision of the bill, that's really important. I know that the DOC is already providing a couple of free phone calls a week and one video session a week free of charge. When we have these, you know, the isolation without physical visits, people with a lot of uncertainty in their lives, it's really, really important that inmates can connect with their family and their loved ones and vice versa. The things I think, you know, that should be considered in this, whether or not you would pass a bill giving the commissioner more authority to do early release, you know, are one is the purpose of that incarceration period that's remaining, and, you know, balance that against all the other considerations. One is, you know, what provides for the health and humane treatment of inmates, which is our duty again, the health and safety of staff. And I really think it's my belief that by reducing the population, that will lower the, you know, provide for more of those operational things to be done that can lower the, you know, the spread of the virus, and that can protect staff. You know, the more the virus is spread in the facilities, the more staff are exposed to it. And then again, the more their families and the broader community are exposed. The other thing I think is really important to consider here is the speed and flexibility to respond appropriately and how much discretion is given to the DOC to do that. If we wait until it's clear that it's needed, it's probably going to be too late. You know, you've seen that being true of a lot of the responses that the state has taken. You know, this isn't an automatic release. This is giving the commissioner that flexibility to make those early releases appropriately, you know, with due consideration for not only public health, but public safety. And again, we can see that that's been done at the local level. I understand it's a different type of population, but the idea is very similar. Two other things to keep in mind, the support upon release. Reentry from prison, as I think you all know, is very difficult in the best of times. It's going to be incredibly difficult now. Again, I think we need to, you know, give the commissioner and his staff some discretion to figure out along, you know, in partnership with somebody being released, what that looks like. Also in my recommendations, I know you didn't plan to put funding forward right now, but my recommendation is also that funding is provided for for community organizations to provide this kind of support. If we have more people being released, we're going to need more of that support for all those organizations that currently provide it. And then I mentioned earlier staff reductions. I don't know that there's been a huge staff reductions yet, but that's a potential issue that needs to be considered. And then I'm just offering a balancing test. Again, the value of keeping everyone in prison for that last 6 months against, you know, the value of giving the commissioner more flexibility if needed and appropriate to release people to promote a humane, safe, and secure condition for both the inmates and staff and help protect the health and the broader community. Just in closing, I would say, you know, in every other area of our life, we've had to take extraordinary measures to respond to this virus. And I would just suggest that, you know, that we should at least consider what potential extraordinary measures are on the corrections response similarly. And with that, I conclude my presentation and look forward to your questions.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Let me do this right now because we do have the Commissioner of Corrections here. And I've just been informed a few minutes ago that he's got a really important meeting he's got to get to. So what I want to do is get him, tee him up right away. There is an amendment that Representative O'Neill has. And so if he's still able to be with us, I'd like Representative O'Neill to then perhaps do a quick, you know, public exchange with him. And let's just see how long we can we have with him. Welcome, Commissioner. Good to see you. And I was just sharing with everyone that you've got something you absolutely got to get to pretty quick. And so I'm just going to let you, you know, dive right in. Can the commissioner hear me?
Now, can you hear me?
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for having me today. I thought I would just take a couple minutes and just provide you with a really brief update and overview, and then I can answer any questions you might have. First, I wanted to just acknowledge and point out and talk a little bit about the tragic death that occurred yesterday at the correctional facility in Moose Lake. A 48-year-old incarcerated man collapsed in the morning, and ultimately EMS responded, and despite efforts to revive him, he did die at the scene. The Moose Lake Police Department, in conjunction with the DOC staff, are doing that investigation, and an autopsy will be performed, or postmortem examination, and COVID testing, is our understanding, will be included with that. To date, the Ombudsman kind of mentioned a couple things. We have a couple of cases that I think since his PowerPoint, there are now three confirmed COVID staff cases at Moose Lake and nine inmate cases, 21 presumed positive cases at Moose Lake, and seven have since been determined to be recovered from this. Facility management is making some internal moves to manage quarantine and isolation practices. But we really are hoping that, you know, the numbers are indicating that there may be a turn here, which we feel is really positive. We're really grateful to the Department of Health, who's been working with us really closely. The Red Wing has had two confirmed positives among staff. And then there has been no youth that have tested positive. There were some quarantines that were done as a precautionary measure, but no, they have been asymptomatic. You should be aware that the DOC has been receiving a growing number of requests for conditional medical releases. Conditional medical releases is grounded in Minnesota law, with the core elements of conditional medical release being that first, an incarcerated person suffers from a grave medical condition. Second, that they do not pose any threat to public safety. And third, that the healthcare costs are borne by a source other than the Department of Corrections. We are receiving a large number of these through private attorneys, as well as the Public Defender's Office, as well as simply requests that are coming in through the population. We are working on standing up a process that we think will be more robust to to look at these cases, which we feel an obligation to do under these circumstances. But always, I think, and first and foremost with anything, we use the lens of public safety as the first kind of reviewing criteria. We've also taken a look and reviewed the medical status of people within our facilities. While our population, about 75% of our population is 45 years of age or less, it is important to note that that we do have a population that does suffer from a range of medical concerns or issues. As a, for instance, I just would point out that between in two facilities, Faribault and Lionel Lakes, there's almost 40 people who are currently receiving chemotherapy. Between those two facilities, there are almost 400 people who have identified respiratory conditions. So I think you can see that some of our population does have some rather significant medical concerns or issues, and our health services staff and medical providers have been mindful of that. But it is difficult to manage this because obviously we don't want to also cohort everybody together because that creates its own set of challenges. But we are working through this, and when there is concerns or complaints about symptoms, we take swift action to make sure those things get addressed. And Mr. Chair, members, as many of you know, the DOC has long operated a work release program to support transition to work and a variety of other activities, including job seeking, vocational training, or educational activities. At any given time across our state for decades, in fact, this was my first experience in corrections just out of college, was working with Department of Corrections people who were being released on work release and making that transition. And that was some 35 years ago, unfortunately, it feels like for me. I would also say that we are finalizing plans to implement and grow, expand work release so that we can move people who are in prison on nonviolent offenses, first and foremost, and second, are within 90 days of their regular release. We selected 90 days as for a number of reasons. One of them is the fact that the process of notification of the counties who are doing supervision, whether it's a Community Corrections Act county or a Department of Corrections county, that process has already begun. And so there is movement around that. And we felt that that was an important place to start this as we move forward. We don't have an exact date for when those things would begin. But our staff are doing finalization of plans, and we anticipate that with the coordination that's necessary, we could start to see some of that expanded use of work release next week. Finally, we would just say that we've had some really good conversations with partners. Been on the phone with the Sheriff's Association and board and all the regional reps to talk about some of the issues that they're concerned about, including expedited testing processes and access to PPE. We've been talking on a twice weekly basis with the jail administrators. I've been having weekly phone calls with a range of community-based advocacy groups and parents of incarcerated people. And we've also have calls with our supervision partners in Community Corrections Act, as well as DOC supervisors across the state. And I think I have another meeting coming up with the victim advocacy community, as we've been doing planning around some of this expansion of work release. We want to make sure that that component is closely connected as we look at work release, especially in light of the information that was provided by law enforcement relative to domestic violence and so forth. As to the bill or the proposal that's been made and in front of you, we have no issues with any of the data components that are required, and have really been trying to increase transparency, both to our staff as well as to the community. We've created some information sites on our website to be able to provide information. We've really worked to increase communication inside. You know, the last thing we want to have is population instability in Minnesota, as they've had in some other places now in the country, but certainly in Italy and other countries, it was pervasive and serious. And we think that the best way to manage that is really through communication and engagement and trying to keep things going and keep the folks who are incarcerated as engaged as possible. And then as it relates to the expansion of the 6-month release, one of the things that a benefit to that is that it just provides a wider range of options as we look at this. Although, you know, we still would be focusing on and using that public safety lens. The reality is that we think that there are ways that that could be accomplished. We're talking also to our partners in supervision because we certainly don't want to overload the system to the point where we end up at risk. But I think it's really important that as we get into this and as we learned from Moose Lake in particular, the ability to move population, the ability to manage these outbreaks becomes very important. I've been on the phone multiple times a week with partners, with the people who have my role in all throughout the Midwest. And we just have been comparing notes and experiences and what's happening, different ideas. And that has been immensely helpful. And while, you know, I think that outbreak at Moose Lake was certainly concerning, we do anticipate that we are going, that there's going to be more of this. I think it's the reality in any and every congregate living setting, as much as we may try to control or tamp that down. And so practicing some of that social distancing are things that we have really tried to build in to the extent that that's possible in a prison setting. And that has been really a process in development because we really felt important and do feel important, our obligation, despite the things that are going on, to make sure that we're not just locking people in, warehousing them, because that has been exactly what has created some of the problems in other countries and, in fact, in other states because they have felt overly confined and lost all ability to have contact with their families in some cases. So that's where things are today at the DOC. We appreciate the opportunity to participate in this hearing today and certainly would stand for any questions that any of you have.
Very well. Thank you, Commissioner. I just want to make sure we're moving expeditiously with your time, and then we're way over our regular time. And members, what I want to do is really aim for a 3:45 close. We're going to have to move quickly here. That puts us at a three-hour hearing. We still have three individuals from the public that have signed up to testify. I do want to get them in very quickly. Commissioner, I don't know if you were on earlier, but you know, our local folks, particularly our sheriff, was quite complimentary about the way in which sheriff departments across the state and DLC have been interacting and conferring and teaching and coordinating one another. And that's exactly the kind of leadership that we need, I think, right now in our state. So I want to thank you, sir, for your professional and diligent leadership during very, very difficult times. I'm going to jump right away to Representative O'Neill. Members, Representative O'Neill has a major amendment language to Section 8, which is the provision that you just addressed, sir, and that Mr. Hossie spoke to. And I would have had her just kind of walk through it, but given the time and moving quickly, I just asked her if she would just jump in, perhaps a question or two for you. And then we want to make sure that you don't feel like you absolutely have to be here if you have to be somewhere else, so don't hesitate to signal that you're going to go. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to start with a simple question. And you can see in this large amendment that I did eliminate the free phone calls in total. And I had this whole thing was drafted in conversation with the DOC, but if the commissioner could just speak a little bit to what the vendors are currently offering and what that would do to their budget if they were asked to exceed what the vendors are already offering for free.
Thank you. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I think when we look at this, we right now we are getting 2 5-minute phone calls for free each week from that is through our vendor. And video visiting is 1 15-minute visit, and then reduced cost to visiting normally would be $10 for 30 minutes. It's now $3.50 for 15 minutes. And the reason it's shortened so much is that they're trying to provide more capacity for people to have video visiting. Opening telephone calls is comes at a significant cost. To give the monthly, I can't recall, but it's about just shy of $2 million for 6 months to bear the complete cost of opening up all phone calls to all incarcerated people for the for a period of 6 months.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that highlights when we talk about budget and the shortfall that we will be facing. There's no doubt about that, that that may not be the best course of action. There is some availability because the vendors have been gracious to offer some free phone calls or reduced calls for video chat. So that is why I eliminated that for both budgetary concerns and the fact that the vendors have stepped forward to do that. The other language may, although it looks like a lot, really is just tightening things, clarifying things, and making some things really specific. And I think it's worth noting as well that to my understanding that the DOC did not come forward and say we need additional authority, and maybe the commissioner could speak to if he feels he needs additional authority to do what he needs to do to keep everyone safe there at the DOC.
And Representative Neal, you're correct. I mean, we fashion recommendations based on the or proposals based on the recommendations of our ombudsperson for corrections. But Representative Schnell, or Commissioner Schnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, I think ultimately the addition of this language is useful, I think, as another tool. I think we are starting with that work release provision and those people within 90 days, because it's certainly reflected in existing authority and it meets exactly with the framework of what we're doing. The one thing I would say, and while all of the elements that we really go through for work release are included in the existing bill. I think it does provide just broader expansion of authority, which makes it a bit easier. I know some of the additional areas of exclusion, which were submitted with your amendment, are certainly things that we would be looking at anyway. I think most broadly, we've been heavily focused on this, on the population that that is within the low-risk population in general, and people who are have committed nonviolent offenses as a top priority, because public safety has to be the number one consideration. At the same time, I do think that it provides a bit more flexibility in terms of moving in that direction. We've been really trying to fit the purpose of this population reduction into a work release status statute, whereas the language being provided here, it really does provide a mechanism for us to release people with legislative approval within the framework that's provided in relative to COVID. And I think the real benefit that could come with that is recognition of the fact that this is a COVID response, as opposed to trying to use, not that we can't, and we certainly are proceeding in that fashion, but we're using a statute that was intended, likely for something else, to accomplish this end. And that's not that it's inappropriate again, but I do think what's being proposed could be beneficial in terms of being very clear about what the scope and purpose of these releases are.
All right. We have I think we have a question from Representative Novotny.
Hold on a second. There we go.
Yep.
Thanks, Chair Mariani. Questions? Two just quick back questions for Commissioner Schnell. First of all, do you have a number of medically fragile prisoners that would be eligible for release? You talked about great numbers. What are those numbers roughly? Have you released anyone that's medically fragile under the authority that you have already? That'll be all. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we have not released anybody relative to COVID. In my year or so, we have used the conditional medical release most of the time. That is really people who are near end of life is where that gets used most commonly. The concern and the legal arguments that are being made is that the combination of COVID and these underlying conditions would create a situation where their condition would become grave. And so one of the things that we're doing is looking at a process whereby we would utilize both Department of Corrections as well as some outside physicians to review both the medical status as well as do the assessment on the public safety side, because that is what the statute requires. So certainly public safety has to be a consideration in conditional medical release situations.
Very well. I don't have any other questions at this point. I do want to maybe just circle very quickly back on the communications issue. You mentioned on managing populations, and you referred to, you know, some circumstances perhaps in other states and even across the nation where if you don't get that right, things get pretty bad is sort of the message I got. I totally get, you know, the whole argument. We're going to be wrestling with budget issues here for quite a while, no doubt. It does seem to me, however, that this entire conversation is about balancing. And I think Mr. Hasse did a really good job of that, of laying out, you know, some of the big high stakes balancing that we've got to do. And, you know, keeping a place of close confinement under a whole lot of stress and tension as safe as possible seems to be one of those high stakes. And so maybe just a very quick word again. I mean, I think we could find ways in which we can, you know, get to a good, you know, directive on our part, you know, guidance, you know, relative to communications. I don't have any doubt of that. But I certainly don't want the public to feel that, and I'm not suggesting anyone here is saying that, but I don't want the public to have an underappreciation of how important communication access in this particular time under these conditions is to making sure that we've got as safe as possible an environment in our facilities. So if there's anything you want to add to that, it's certainly all ears.
Mr. Chair and members, I would just say that I can't underscore, literally the hundreds of emails that I'm getting on a week-to-week basis from family members of people who are incarcerated, who are very worried, people that are on the inside. And I think this whole notion of population stability is really important from a safety standpoint in our corrections facilities and really in our community. And I think, you know, we are having to look at public health and public safety as not being mutually exclusive considerations. And I think as we see around the country, I would just close with this, as we see around the country, what's happening more and more is that we're seeing large lawsuits, habeas cases where in New York, a habeas case was filed. A number of people were released because of the conditions that COVID created in line with medical conditions that people had. So cruel and unusual punishment. Willful indifference arguments are being made in courts across the United States. And I think as a state, we want to make sure that we're doing all we can to recognize our constitutional obligations, moral obligations, and legal obligations, and at the same time, making sure we're balancing all of the interests to the extent that it's possible. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak to that, and especially on behalf of our staff, who I got to just would say one little plug, I'm so immensely proud of, like healthcare workers, these folks are coming into our correctional facilities knowing that COVID spread is a significant real reality in a confined setting. And I'm immensely proud of them and really grateful to our population, who has really, I think, to date, worked with us quite well. So Minnesota is fortunate to have great DOC staff that I think have been doing a remarkable job. And I think that's been reflected in the response of the population.
Commissioner, I'm going to let you run. On that note, please convey to our rank and file public servants there that the legislators here on both sides of the aisle, looking out for them as best as we can. And we do, they are important to us as well. So thank you, sir.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Take care.
All right. Very well. Members, we've got a few minutes left. We do have three individuals. So I'm going to ask them to come on. They are Justin Terrell, Mitch Christensen, and Rob Doerr. Mr. Hosker, I invite you to stay, but not requiring that you do, in case there might be some questions for you as well. But I do want to get these public, this testimony of people from or citizens who went through our process to sign up. And so with that, I'm going to ask if Justin Terrell is on, is presently here. Okay, apparently there's someone speaking for him. Jasmine? In the same shop, Jasmine?
Yep.
Very well. I don't think I have your last name, Jasmine, but you're with the Council of African Heritage.
Yep, Jasmine Carey. I'm the Legislative and Policy Director for the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage.
Welcome. You know, we only have a couple minutes at most for each of our testifiers, so just to be forearmed.
Okay, no problem. I will keep it very brief.
Thank you.
Yeah, so today I'm just giving a statement in support of the Ombudsman for Corrections COVID-19 recommendations that were given. We believe these recommendations are specific and intentional solutions needed to address the challenges that exist when dealing with a COVID-19 pandemic in our correction systems at the moment. Individuals in our correctional facilities are more vulnerable to the virus due to the enclosed quarters, difficulty in maintaining, the sanitary conditions, and given the racial disparities that exist, and historically knowing who's been overlooked when it comes to these things, we just want to ensure that there are proper protocols and things in place so that way we can get this under control for those who are in our facilities in the correctional facilities across the state. The recommendations that were presented by the Ombudsman take a holistic approach and cover the myriad concerns that exist, including the prioritizing those who do not pose a threat to public safety, providing public access to the population numbers, as well as those resources that were presented that we believe that those will help those specific barriers that may exist for those who are going to be released early, as well as the conditions that are being presented with the pandemic. So we just would like to urge all of you legislators, as you're making decisions on what will go in this bill, to put these recommendations in there because those who need to be protected and who need extra protected aren't able to speak up at this point in time. And that's why we want to make sure that we're able to put particular things in place because, this event is very unprecedented. And we need to ensure that we're able to take the best approach to assist everyone.
That's all right. Well, thank you, Ms. Carey. Very concise and to the point. Thank you for your work at the Minnesota Council of African Heritage. We have a lot of your constituents, unfortunately, represented in our corrections system. So this is, I can imagine, a high priority for the council to address. So. I thank you for your comments and your encouragement and your work.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to move over to Midge Christensen.
Yes.
Very well.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani. Thanks for having me. I will be very brief. I know everybody's wanting to get on their way. I just wanted to say also thanks for the tech people behind the scenes who are making this work for all of us who are not technologically savvy. World go round and round right now.
I am Midge Christensen. I'm the president for the MACAC Association. I'm also the director for Chippewa, Carl Swift, and Yellow Medicine Community Corrections. We do realize as an organization that we are in some pretty serious times right now, and all measures need to be investigated and contemplated as far as protecting the population that is in the community or in the prison system right now. We do have some concerns regarding releasing a chunk of offenders out into the community. As you recall, we were pretty significantly behind the eight ball already as far as funding for delivering adequate supervision in Minnesota. And so the possibility of having an additional group of folks on top of that without funding is very concerning to us. One of the things I would like to say is that I know that the commissioner mentioned that we are, he would be focusing on low risk folks, but low risk doesn't mean low risk in the community. It means low risk relative to the remainder of the population in the prison facility. So we're still dealing with folks who are going to be facing some significant challenges. They already have difficulty with housing and employment and health and things like that. And so releasing them at this time is going to add additional stress. At the same time in the field, we're trying our best to accommodate supervision in a different environment for the offenders we already have. And so while we're trying to do as much video conferencing and in distance and things like that, we've got a lot of offenders who don't have access to that technology on their end. They don't have good reception out here in the rural areas as far as broadband and that the type of thing. And then for our own staff safety, the sheriff was talking about PPE. We are significantly challenged with PPE as far as field services, especially in the rural area. We're talking not even masks and that type of thing. And so if we're looking at bringing an additional chunk of offenders out, that's one thing that we would really need to take a significant look at. I think that it goes without saying that trading one problem for another is not what we're after here. And so we would want return to the community to be successful return to the community and not come with a trade-off of additional public safety risks and increase in offenses. So for us in CCA, I think that we would have a hard time accommodating a significant chunk if there were not funding that came with it. And this is going to go on, as you have alluded to, this is not the next 2 weeks problem. This is going to be ongoing for some time. And so figuring out how to accommodate these folks and deal with the change up on our end while still protecting public safety is going to be a significant challenge for us. Just one other thing I wanted to ask quickly. So we've looked at, it's about 40 supervised release clients to one agent. And supervised release agent salary and benefits, et cetera, the average in Minnesota is anywhere from $100,000 to $120,000. So that does not include the change up in technology that we're trying to deal with. I'm getting enough devices to do video visiting, broadband, all of those extra costs. So that's just the marker that we've been going by when you want to look at how many the DOC is potentially looking at releasing.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Christensen. And you know, I did post an amendment, which I'm not going to get into because it's not, you know, our directive at this point to be attempting to move appropriations. But really it was to, A, to get me in trouble with leadership, my own leadership, but B, you know, just to, you know, make sure that we don't forget the points that you just made, you know, that there is no, it's counterproductive for us in many ways to just continue to fill the cup of our, you know, frontline probation officers under incredible stress, unless there are resources that come along with that. And my hope is that that will therefore then be an ongoing conversation as we move forward through the rest of this session, even as we're reacting as quickly as we can right now, primarily in policy. But your point is very well taken. Those challenges were there prior to COVID. They're only more astute now. And I think you can count on me and several of my colleagues here on the committee to make sure that we're strongly voicing the need to properly resource our ability to keep Minnesota safe. That means keeping you guys, you men and women, safe on the front lines too. So Well, thank you. Members, I know I'm moving very quickly. I apologize, but I got to do it. Last is Rob Dorn. I'm wondering if Rob is there.
I am here, if you can hear me.
Sí, ¿cómo estás, señor Dorn?
Bien, gracias.
Muy bien. Good to see you.
A ti también. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senior Chair, and members of the committee. It's great to talk to you guys, and I really appreciate you guys actually making this forum available. And hopefully the kinks and the frustrations can get worked out and it can be a little more productive in the future. But thank you guys for at least making this much available. I'll move quick.
And I don't know if you caught me earlier, but, you know, we're like way over time, so I got to do really quick. So I apologize, but that's what it is. What it is.
Okay. I'm going over the hitting section four real quick. The reason why this section is particular interest to us is because a gross misdemeanor conviction under this section does render somebody ineligible to possess a firearm. So it is a section that we watch very closely. Particularly with this section, I'm looking at the top of page six, the first nine lines there, where it talks about substantial emotional distress. The bottom of page five goes on to define family or household member. It has the meaning in 518B. Personal information has the meaning in 617, but it doesn't define substantial emotional distress. And I understand from a great conversation with Representative Pinto that this is copied from federal law, but federal law doesn't define it either. And this is something that has been brought up to the appellate court and has been sought for certiorari with the Supreme Court about the definition of substantial emotional distress. So I think it'd be incumbent on the state to make sure that if they do want to put that bar on this, that there's actually a definition associated with that. So I hope that Chair Lesch, as it goes through his committee, as I understand this is informational only, that they'll look at actually providing some definition there so that we don't end up in the same situation a couple years down the road fighting this, another toss out of the legislation that's considered to be overly broad because there's no real definition set. So that's about as quick and as short as I can make it.
Mr. Dorn, thank you so much for accommodating. And we did have a bit of a conversation about this earlier. And obviously a much longer conversation is needed. We are obviously trying to move as quickly as we can, but it's important to have the public input so that when we miss things, we see them and we can, address them as best as we can. With that, members, you know, there are documents for the public as well, that are available. I think these are going to be available on our website. I'll check our website, the PowerPoint presentations. There's some written testimony from Decarcerate, from Children's Hope International, from NAMI, from YIPA, and also ACLU testimony. Members, this is going to conclude our hearing. Representative Jackson, I'll reach out to you shortly to see if we can figure out a way to move forward together with some good ideas. And my hope is that we'll have another virtual hearing sometime very soon. I want to thank all the testifiers for being here with us today, for the patience of our committee members who sat through a very long committee hearing. So with that, be safe, be well, spread the word about being safe and be well and sheltering at home and looking out for one another. And until then, I want to, at this point, call us to adjourn.
Mr. Chair, before we adjourn, I have a question.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Dorr before he leaves.
Representative O'Neill, it's going to have to be super, super quick. I was moving to adjourn us, and it looked like Mr. Dorr was certainly fine with offering the testimony that he did. But if we could do this, like in a matter of seconds, that would be acceptable to me.
Well, I think this is incredibly important. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is incredibly important. And Mr. Dorr, could you speak to page six, line seven and eight, when it says causes attempts to cause or would reasonably be expected to cause substantially emotional distress to another person. Can you speak specifically to what your thoughts are and how that would affect gun owners specifically about attempts to cause or would reasonably be expected to cause specifically that language?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. I think part of the issue with that comes is our issue is particularly one that's very divisive and invokes a lot of emotions. Our members have been called threatening and harassing just by their mere presence, by wearing one of our T-shirts. So that's why I think it's really incumbent on the legislature to make sure that the level of substantial emotional distress is defined so that it's not quite subjective and open to interpretation. Trying to be very quick.
Very well, thank you. Appreciate you getting that on the record.
And Mr. Chair, I know you don't want to do any other testifiers. I'll simply note that I know that the testifiers from the victim community are very eager to engage in this. I'll be happy to do that with Representative O'Neill and Mr. Dorr another time.
That seems fair.
Because there's some strong responses to that, and I think good work we can do together on it. Thank you.
All right. Members, let's do our best to keep Minnesota safe as we go forward in the coming days here. Again, thank you all for participating, and this committee meeting stands adjourned.